Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to a special 2.5-hour episode of Movie Geeks United. Tonight, in celebration of the 10th anniversary of the film Titanic, actress Jeanette Goldstein. Then, the director of Enchanted, the number one family movie in America, Kevin Lima. Plus, director Andrew P. Jones and actor Glenn Turman discuss their new film, Kings of the Evening. And author John Gaspard teaches us the ins and outs of low-budget filmmaking from the pros. Finally, from National Treasure, Book of Secrets, actor Michael Mays. Now, sit back and dim the lights. It's time to get your geek on. Here are your hosts for Movie Geeks United, Jamie and Jerry.
Movie Geeks United is up and on the air. How's everyone out there doing? Great show tonight, a packed show. If you have a passion for movies as we do, you're probably, as we are, licking your chops.
Yes.
This is going to be a great one. My name is Jamie. I'm one of the co-hosts for the evening on Movie Geeks United. My fellow co-host, Jerry, is right here. Hey.
Hey, what's up, everyone?
How you doing, man?
Dude, we got this is the big one.
This is the bomb jiggity.
Yep, it is.
It's a great show. Just a couple of notes before we get started tonight. You can call in if you have questions for any of the guests, or you can call in our show number at 718-508-9477, or you can submit questions through the chat room. Jerry is manning the chat room right now. The chaos that is bound to ensue in the chat room when everyone starts logging on at once.
Yes.
He'll be taking care of that for us.
Yeah, so feel free, and then please feel free to call in, too.
Absolutely. We have a great big show for you tonight. We air every Sunday at 6 p.m. Eastern, and usually Wednesdays at 10 p.m. Eastern, but it's a 2.5-hour show tonight, so we bumped it up an hour to make way for all of these fantastic guests tonight.
Right.
But just a quick note, we do have John Sayles joining us on Sunday night at 6 p.m. Eastern, a legendary independent filmmaker. That's going to be a great revealing.
That'll be incredible.
That's going to be a great interview right there. And then next month, we're bringing you a lot of the Sundance competition filmmakers. We're in talks right now to schedule a lot of those films that are in competition, and we're talking about some great talent on both sides of the camera, acting, professional directors, producers. We're going to have a field day with that. So,
yes, we are.
It's going to be a great month next month as well. Let's get started. We have such a packed show tonight. Let's do it.
Let's do it.
Okay. Here we go. On December 19th, 1997, exactly 10 years ago to this day, James Cameron's Titanic was unleashed upon the world. The pre-release speculation rivaled that of Apocalypse Now, at times painting an unfavorable portrait of a perfectionist filmmaker losing control of a troubled production befuddled by rising costs and continuous delays. But to simply say that the struggles of this epic shoot paid off would be a gross understatement. Earning a whopping worldwide total of $1.8 billion in its theatrical run, Titanic became and has remained the number one film of all time, outgrossing its second-place international contender, The Return of the King, by more than $700 million.
Wow.
But much more profound than mere dollars and cents, this timeless, action-packed romancer also won and united the hearts of moviegoers all across the globe. Tonight we'll be assessing the enormous impact the film has made in pop culture and in influencing how films are made and marketed. But first, we hear an insider's perspective on what it was like to work on this mammoth-scaled masterpiece. Our guest tonight has worked with James Cameron three times in her career. In Aliens, she was the tougher-than-nails Private Vasquez. She played John Connor's stepmother in Terminator 2 Judgment Day. And in Titanic, she gave a memorably moving performance as the Irish mother. Her exceptional career achievements are by no means limited to Cameron's films, though. She's also delivered vivid and versatile work in classic films like Lethal Weapon 2 and Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas and The Presidio and Near Dark, and in television series like 24 and ER. It is a great pleasure to welcome the extraordinary actress Jeanette Goldstein to our program. Jeanette, are you with us?
I am.
Thank you so much for being with us tonight.
No, thank you for inviting me.
Your work in Cameron's films are amazing, particularly Cameron's films, and I want to know how you got started in the business and how you first met James Cameron, because Aliens was your first feature film, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. I went to drama school in New York at Circle in the Square, and I also went to drama school in London. And I was working in the theater, and you know, had no training really to work on television or film, and just sort of stumbled into the audition and got it. It was my first film.
Were you aware that it was Aliens? Were you aware of the type of film it was or the caliber of film it was when you
auditioned? I wasn't, because I went for an open call, because I didn't have an agent in those days. So I went for an open call, and I knew the name of it, but I just sort of discounted that it could be the sequel because it had been so long.
Right.
And the funny thing is they were specifically looking for American actors who had British equity cards. And in England, when you have your green card, they call it your resident alien card. Mm. That's what it's called. So I assumed, oh, they're looking at a story about resident aliens. So I had no idea until they told me, and then I was, you know, oh, my God, yeah, that's such a great film. Like,
oh, well.
Of course I've heard of it.
So you and Cameron have worked together three times. What clicked between the two of you?
You know, I just understood him. I mean, when he casts you, he has complete trust in you, and you know, you just sort of give him what's either, you know, on the page or what you come up with. And if he doesn't like it, he will certainly tell you.
Right.
But I mean, if it works, I mean, it just stays in there, and he's incredibly loyal, as you can see, to everyone he works with, you know, who he likes and respects. And I, you know, feel the same way about him. I think he's fantastic, and you know.
Well, obviously he's a filmmaker that, and particularly with this next movie he's working on, I think he's going to change the form of cinema. I think that that's his place, and he's the perfect director to do that. But you hear the tough, demanding perfectionist and that kind of title thrown at him. I don't know what the alternative is that you continuously settle for, you know.
You want to work for a mediocre, yeah. Slightly incompetent.
Yeah. Yeah, the good enough director, you know.
Yeah, vaguely talented.
Yeah, tell me about what it's like to be direct. How does he direct actors? What is that like?
Well, he just, you know, it's funny. He comes from the technical end, and he trusts you to do your job. I mean, I. The compliment I give him is that in the writing, it's all there. I mean, the logic.
Yeah.
The logic is there. So as an actor, if you don't have a script that makes any sense, then it's, you know, then it becomes very difficult. But now he really much, he stands back. He's a real craftsman. I mean, he's a real, he's not a social animal. He doesn't say things he doesn't need to make you feel good. He's all about the work. And I mean, I love that. I really respond to that.
Yeah, and he pulls fantastic performances out of his actors.
Yeah, he really does.
It is amazing. But before we get into Titanic, I want to hear about kind of the highlights for you for both of these experiences prior to Titanic, the Aliens and the Terminator 2. What sticks out for you, memories from those shoots?
Well, Aliens was my first film, so I was just at times, you know, completely overwhelmed and terrified, and I depended so much on the other actors, you know, Bill Paxton and Lance and all the other soldiers, because they'd been in lots of films, and I, you know, didn't know the first thing about the language of film, you know,
right.
Like a master shot or what's, you know, I vaguely heard of what a close-up was, obviously, I knew that, so, I mean, so I remember being very cold, because it was shot all in London on Pinewood Studios, and they don't keep the actors very warm. So, and I don't know. It was felt like being in the Army.
Yeah. Did you guys do a boot camp kind of thing for that, or?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we got 2 weeks before we started filming, which is, you know, really generous and kind of unheard of. And we got training with some army, there's sort of like a special services version of the British Army, I forget what it's called, in urban warfare and small arms, and absolutely, because I've never held a gun before in my life. So.
Yeah, but you were in it, man. I mean, you were a soldier.
You never held a gun in your life, and you are the, you know, the hard as nails as they come in those films.
That's right.
Yeah.
So when Terminator 2 came around, did he offer you that part straight out, or was it another audition process, or?
No, that one he offered straight out. I mean, we'd sort of joked that after I'd finished Aliens, all the roles that were offered to me were of like tough Latinas, and
right.
they were shocked when I walked in the room, and they said, "Why, you know?" And he used to say, "Well, can't they see you're an actor, and you should play a mother, a sweet mother, you know?"
Yeah.
So I said, "I'd love to." So he said, "Here you go. Here's a mother. She's not that sweet, but."
As it turns out, yeah.
Right, yeah. But I was a mother though, so that was good.
But it must be amazing to see these. Do you have a sense on these films that we're talking about when you're in the middle of them, how massive they are, and what kind of potential they have to reach the world while you're working on them?
I have a sense of how massive they are from the sets. I mean, from the Alien sets and especially the Titanic
right.
set. As far as what they'll do and their effect, I mean, that's, you never know, and that's out of your hands, and, who knows?
Yeah.
With Titanic, oh, my God, the set was unbelievable, astounding. I mean, you felt as if you were on the Titanic.
It absolutely has to be priceless for the actor to be in that, such a meticulously recreated environment like that.
But no acting necessary. I'd walk down these hallways, basically lost. I was trying to find my way back, and you'd be shocked to run into a lighting stand because you were so into the world of the film. Everything was absolutely realistic, and then there was like a guy holding a light. It was shocking. So,
you shot this in Titanic was shot in Mexico, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And how long were you involved in that project?
That, for me, considering everybody else was involved, it was very short. I was just down there 2 weeks.
Okay.
And that had a lot to do. All my scenes were with children, so in that way I was very lucky. You could only shoot during certain hours. And
right. And your scenes are real. I mean, they're some of the most moving scenes in that film. And I'm wondering how long into the shoot did you come on? And how did you feel it was difficult to kind of acclimate yourself to that kind of environment coming in when you did?
Well, I think I came in toward the end of the shoot. I can't, it's hard to remember. But every time you come into a film, I mean, it's like first day at school.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you come into a series, people have been with each other forever and you come in, so I always feel that way. But, I mean, it was different for me because I was working with Jim for the third time, and so many of the people, technical people he'd worked with, and, I mean, it's great. It's great. It's like, it's really lovely because you'd notice the same people.
Yeah, yeah.
And,
I'm sorry, go right ahead, I'm sorry.
I was saying it was a huge film, but my scenes were so small and so intimate.
Yes.
Intimate.
But could you sense, since this is obviously the biggest, Cameron's made a career out of making these huge movies, and this is as big as it gets for any director, Titanic. Mm-hmm. Did you get a sense of a different way of working or a different environment? Was there more of kind of a, I don't want to say a pressure cooker environment, but what was the environment like? Was it similar to those other Cameron sets?
Well, I'll tell you, and each one is different. It's always a pressure cooker because he works very fast and very thorough, and he comes from Roger Corman, low budget. So
yeah.
There's no, even though it's the budget's gone up, there's no fat, there's no extra. It was different because everybody was speaking Spanish and English. It was all being translated live because all the extras were Mexican nationals.
Yeah.
And we were in the first scene where I'm with the little boy and girl, and we're being crushed against the gate. So as they locked it,
yeah.
Where he says, what's going on, mommy? And the little boy had never been on camera before. Maybe he'd done a commercial. And when he did it, and Jim said, "All right, let's do another take." He said, "Why didn't I do it right?" And then Jim stops the whole production. He goes right next to me. He goes, "Oh, let me tell you how it all works. We shoot it once, and then we shoot it again, and then maybe we'll go to the other side of you. And so we might do it like 10 times. Is that all right? Is that okay? Can you do it?" And he goes, "Okay, all right."
Oh,
it was,
wow.
You just bend down to him to sort of explain to him how it was hundreds of people around, just to tell this little 4-year-old how it worked.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
Does he do that? Is he a multi-take Is he kind of, does he take a lot of takes of shots?
You know, I don't know. I mean, there wasn't that many. It's funny, this was like kind of the only sort of personal, intimate scenes I did, and he gets, there's no technical stuff involved in, mm-hmm. in the Titanic scene. So there were, I don't recall there being that many, but in, let's say, Terminator 2, when we had to get the knife thing to work coming out of Xander Berkeley's, the back of his neck, and
right.
all that takes, that stuff takes, you know, forever until you get it right.
Yeah.
And, you know, it has to be right. So he does it as many times as he needs to.
Well, I know that you came on to do 2 weeks of shooting, like you said, but did you study on Titanic prior to coming on? What kind of research did you do, and how was that helpful to you?
Well, I studied about the Titanic, and especially the immigrants down in the third decks, which you didn't, you know, normally hear about.
Yeah.
The you know, how many of them had died and who they were. And I was very fortunate to, when I was there before shooting, one of the musicians was Irish, and he was telling me about, he's the one who gave me the bedtime story that I tell the kids, because in the script it just says she puts them to sleep. And Jim said, you know, do whatever you want to do. I don't know, sing them a song or, you know, whatever you come up with. And this actor came up to me and was like, well, you've got to do this. You've got to, you know, all our mothers say this to us. It's a, you know, an amazing story. And so we wrote it down, and then I just sort of paraphrased, you know, a bit of it, The Land of Tir na n'Og, the fairy tale.
Yeah. Wow, what a haunting moment in that film. That was.
Thank you.
Now, were you surprised that it caught on like it did? I mean, obviously it has all the elements to be a massively successful movie, but it's still the number one film of all time. What do you attribute that to?
God, you know, it seems like people went back to see it over and over.
Well, they had to have, yeah.
That was unheard of today.
Yeah.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, I know that's what I kept hearing from, you know, people I knew and, you know, neighbors and, you know, and I don't know. I mean, I live in a very Spanish neighborhood, and they would all go, you know, see it. Even though they didn't understand English very well, I mean, the huge melodrama, and they knew the story and went back to see it over and over. It was really amazing.
Wow.
So that's the only thing I know about it.
Now, are you still in touch with Mr. Cameron at all? Or
mm-hmm.
did he approach you at all for Avatar?
I read for one of the roles, but this actress, I don't know, her name is Sigourney Weaver. I don't know.
Oh, a little actress.
She's a little actress. She actually, we were reading for the same role, so I think I believe she's going to be doing it. But yeah, no, he had. We had been talking about, you know, just the whole process. I'm trying to wrap my head around it. I still don't understand what he's talking about. But you know,
it's going to be something to see, I'm sure.
Yeah. Oh my God. Oh, it's amazing.
It'll be the landmark film of that year, without a doubt.
Oh yeah, that would have to be. But I think it's safe to say that, you know, before we go, I want to get some other information on you, but I think it's safe to say that your first love is the theater. Seeing that you've performed some of the great classics, what do you get from theater acting that you can't necessarily find with film acting?
Well, I'm in a play right now. I'm in rehearsal for a play, and it usually has to do with the writing. And, I mean, you could find great writing absolutely in film and television. I mean, Sopranos and you know, Deadwood. I mean, it's there. And the scale of the characters and the human beings. And sometimes I find film and television that they want it small. You know, they're trying to just sort of erase all the interesting things about human beings and the largeness. And in the theater, you know, it's expected to be bigger than life and deal with issues that are huge, and you know, the immediacy of it, I love film too. I mean, I love sitting in a movie theater and watching movies. Being on the other side is fantastic too. But I mean, I'm really excited. I'm loving rehearsing this play right now.
So what play are you doing now?
It's called Frozen.
Mm.
And it's an English play. It was on Broadway a few years ago with Susie Kurtz.
Okay.
I'm playing that role. It was, I think it won a couple of Tonys. It's a wonderful, wonderful play.
And where's that being put on?
It's in Los Angeles at the Lillian Theater,
okay.
which is in Hollywood.
Right. So what's next for you outside of the play? I understand that you've done some writing and directing of your own, haven't you?
I did. A while ago, I did a short film. I directed, wrote, and directed a short film. And I have a film coming out in the new year called Autopsy, which is a light little, a little romantic comedy. it's a horror. It's a real genre film.
Yeah.
And it's actually great. It's a very black humor. Near Dark was one of the favorite films of this writer director.
Oh, so, Near Dark is fantastic.
Okay. This will be incredible then. All right.
Yeah.
Oh, it's got a beautiful, beautiful look. Like, you know how Near Dark had gorgeous cinematography.
Mm. Yeah. Near Dark is a classic in my book. So.
Oh yeah.
Well, when that comes out in the new year, Autopsy, if you could come back and join us, we'd love to hear more about it.
Oh, sure. I'd love to.
But thank you so much for being with us tonight and sharing your experiences with us. And you're welcome back on any time. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
That is Jeanette Goldstein. She is a co-star of Titanic and many other terrific Cameron films. We're honored to have the opportunity to speak with her tonight. And thank you so much.
You just spoke to an icon. You realize that.
She really is. You know that in a series of iconic movies,
yes,
she is responsible for some of the most iconic moments.
Yes. I mean, we just spoke to a legend.
Absolutely.
I mean,
absolutely.
I'm not making light of that. We just really, it's incredible. Wow. You got to forgive me. It's just like mind blowing.
Yeah.
It really is.
So let's talk a little bit about Titanic before we bring our next guest up. But how it changed things. There's a couple of things that come to my mind. One is that, you know, we're talking about it was the most expensive movie ever made at the time.
At the time, yeah.
$200 million. And everyone scoffed at it. It inspired the first. I think it was the first co-production between two studios.
Yes, it was, yes.
Now we see that's common practice to spend that much money on an event movie, and it's common practice to do the co-production route.
Right.
And I remember when Titanic came out, they said no matter how successful this film is, there's no reason to spend $200 million to make a movie. And now, what's short?
Now we have three movies this year. I think it cost $300 million to make. So
I know, it's insane. And it's barely spoken about anymore in a detrimental kind of, in a negative kind of connotation.
Yeah.
But another thing that's interesting to me, Titanic survived. I mean, you don't gross that much money from a good weekend. I mean, it thrived. I think it was number one for 15 weeks.
It was until April, until Lost in Space came out, it was number one.
Which is unheard of. But it opened at something like $28.7 million, somewhere around that neighborhood.
And you have to take it all, the running time, too, was 3 hours. So even at that time,
right?
And that's an incredible amount of money.
But we're looking at now something like The Golden Compass, which isn't a short movie, and it costs more.
Yeah.
And it grossed around that ballpark its opening weekend, and it's deemed a failure.
Big failure.
I don't recall that kind of language whenever Titanic.
Before Titanic, no, after Titanic, a couple years after Titanic, it became common practice.
Yeah. And isn't it just what if that happened to it today? What if it was met by this is a failure after its first weekend?
I don't know, because it's like what we mentioned to Jeanette, it had the repeat business. It had the people going back and seeing it again. Even with something like the Lord of the Rings movies, which did have, or the last Star Wars movies, where people, you know, the fans kept going back, still, or the Spider-Man movies, still, though, because the audience is not that broad. Here, Titanic appealed to everyone. But would it today with the, I don't know if it would do the kind of business today. I just don't see it happening.
It's just incredible. It's like one, the eighth wonder of the world.
Yeah.
How can anything come close to that?
Yeah, and I don't even know if his next movie, I will promise you this, though, about his next movie. It will be groundbreaking technologically, regardless of anything else. People will be copying that, the technique from that movie.
He's really taken the mantle from George Lucas.
He has to. George Lucas sort of, I think, retired with The Revenge of the Sith, because I have a friend, Dennis, who's worked on the special effects for the Matrix films and for the upcoming Speed Racer, and he even said that what Cameron does is the next big thing.
Yeah.
Everyone's looking for that.
All eyes will be on this.
Yes,
one.
Everybody will be on
that. And the thing is like Lucas, Cameron is a fantastic storyteller.
Yes.
But he's also...
He's better
a
with
great
actors.
Writer. I mean, he's a great writer.
Yes.
And those are, you know, different kind of different in a way, you know.
Oh yes, no. He likes I think he actually enjoys working with actors.
Yeah.
I don't always get that with Lucas, even from the story, you know, faster, more intense, or intense, faster.
Yeah, and sometimes I've heard interviews with directors where they ask them, what is your favorite direction? And that's what they'll say, faster, slower.
Yeah.
I think Chris Walken said that. What do you like to hear from a director? He's like, slower, faster. Do it slower.
Do you think there's anything on the horizon that you see over the next year with some of these, you know, big event comic book movies or whatever? Do you see anything approaching Titanic?
No, I don't. And I think it's one of those things where...
Not even Indiana Jones?
It united... No, I mean, obviously Indiana Jones is going to be huge, but there's something about Titanic and the way it really went straight to the heart of people.
Yeah,
you know?
It's universal.
They took ownership of this movie in a way, and it's odd for people to do that with such a big budget movie. We're
right.
Talking about a little The Sunshine that it becomes an audience favorite, but Titanic I think was much the same way, where they really took it into their heart and it became a part of them for whatever reason. And I think that's gold. I don't think that can be necessarily calculated or
No, I agree. It's a people's movie, no doubt.
Well, to go back and see something like five or six times in the theater.
It's incredible.
Yeah. We want to hear from you guys. If you guys have any thoughts about Titanic or any of the other topics we'll be covering on tonight's show, just give us a call at 718-508-9477. Jerry's there in the chat room.
They're talking about the Halloween DVD.
Yeah, isn't that something?
I know, which is cool. That's fine. I like the movie. Don't get me wrong, but
talk amongst yourselves.
Yeah.
But he's manning the chat room, so if you want to submit any questions through that chat room,
feel free.
And that includes questions for us too.
Yeah.
I mean, we're not just some schmoes sitting around here.
Yeah.
We know our stuff. But a great show for you tonight. Still left. Heard from the wonderful Jeanette Goldstein about the Titanic and all of her other collaborations with Cameron. And we're about to speak to Kevin Lima, the director of the number one family film in America, Enchanted, which I actually got a chance to see the other night, Jerry.
Yeah.
And I know that you've seen it, too. And it's.
We took my niece to see it.
It is a delightful movie. It really is.
Yes, it is. I have no problem. Women.
Yeah, I know everyone in the chat room are talking about Halloween.
Let me
talk to you a little bit about the Walt Disney's Enchanted. it really is a great film.
It is. Amy Adams. Amy Adams. You got to forgive me because our very good friend John Medina just left a comment. You say slow like it's a bad thing.
Yeah, I don't mean that it's a bad thing. I'm sorry.
No, but you know what I like about it? Amy Adams is, like, perfect in that role. I mean, she was awesome in Junebug, and I just think it's so great that, like, the mainstream audiences can see her, and, like, hopefully they'll go back and watch Junebug.
She really is, and I think she actually, which is interesting to me, she actually auditioned for that role. And I don't know if this was before or after her nomination for Junebug.
True. I'm not sure.
She auditioned for her role in Enchanted, so I'm interested in hearing about that. But
mm-hmm.
A wonderful movie, and you know, I as an adult, I kind of I like my dramas, you know, I like my idea movies and that kind of thing. So it really takes something for me to go into a Disney film, and the thing about it is, I'm never disappointed. They're always so enjoyable and infectious and. They leave a smile on your face.
Right, especially the Pixar, for the most part, the Pixar movies.
Yes. And this one is just like that.
Yeah, this is a nice send-up of they're, you know, I think it's great because only Disney could do a really good send-up of their films, and
yeah.
It works.
Yeah. I'm posting something right now. But, yeah, it's an incredible movie. And the theater audience that I saw it with was just, I mean, they're in it. They're in it. And
they're
fantastic actors.
Totally.
Fantastic actors in that movie.
You know who's good in the movie? Patrick Dempsey.
Yes.
And I'm glad, you know, I remember Patrick Dempsey going up, like, in high school in a lot of the movies, the teenage comedies. And it's, I guess, this Grey's Anatomy has given him a whole new lease in life. And he was just great in it.
He really is. And, you know, it kind of, you're right, because we're used to, I think, it wasn't He Can't Buy Me Love? And
that's the one. That's
yeah, and we're used to, we're of that age group where we used to see him in those films.
Right.
We're not necessarily TV people.
Right.
So he's a man now. I mean, he's come into his own as a
right.
as an adult actor, and he's a very definite, strong presence
yeah.
in this movie. And, you know, any love story, so to speak, it takes two partners for it to work, you know, and he's right there with Amy Adams every step of the way.
Yeah, totally.
Susan Sarandon as the evil...
She was good. She's had a good year. She was, even though she's only in a couple scenes
right.
in the Valley of Elah, her scenes with Tommy Lee Jones are incredibly powerful. And she was even good in one of the, you know, the same week. She's in Mr. Woodcock. And she's, you know what? She's good in that, you know?
Yeah, yeah. You can't miss with Susan Sarandon.
Yeah.
So the number to dial into the show, if you want to ask a question of our next guest, 718-508-9477. Everyone on the chat room, thanks for joining us tonight. And get everybody together. If you have any friends out there that are interested in the remainder of this show, get them on the chat room and have them be listening in, because this is a massive, massive show tonight.
Yes, it is.
So let's talk while we're waiting for Mr. Lyman to call in. Talk a little bit about what's going on in the news around Hollywood.
Okay.
This week, we spoke about the writer's strike briefly.
Yes, it gets. I think it gets more and more complicated.
Yeah, but the latest is the Globes and the Oscars.
Yeah, I have to be honest with you. I don't know. And I heard, what is it, the People's Choice Awards? They just canceled. CBS, I think, canceled those.
No kidding.
That it might just be something where they might do it online, or they might, I'm not positive, but I think they have canceled them.
It might be the people's choice, but it's not the writer's choice.
No, it's not. And, you know, I'm you know, rooting for the writers here. We want them because, you know, as a lot of people point out, if you go to Deadline Hollywood, Nikki Fink's site, and you read the comments, you know, you don't have anything without the writers.
Right.
And it seems like on both sides the talks broke down, and I don't know how you get them back. I don't know what's going to happen.
It's going to be something. I mean, it's starting to cripple the industry, as we're seeing.
Yeah. Now, John in the chat room just said the talk shows are coming back in January, but we're not sure exactly how that's going to work. They're still negotiating that, and the Writers Guild is very upset about that.
Well, I think that Leno and O'Brien are coming back without writers, right?
Yeah, so they can't do... I heard something, you can't do a monologue. The Writers Guild said you can't do a...
Well, thank goodness for that.
You're right. But, and something John just said, that they're negotiating with Letterman and Leno. Oh, well, they're negotiating with Letterman, and Leno is going to wing it. Okay.
See, Leno's winging it. Letterman is looking for a special, separate WGA... contract for his writers.
That's right.
Yeah. Letterman's always been pretty steadfast in supporting his writers.
Yes, he
has. The thing to take into consideration, this is their defense, Leno and O'Brien. Look, they have a full staff of producers, assistants, that kind of thing.
Right.
That are out of work as well because of this.
Yeah, everyone's right now is out of work. But I just don't. I don't remember, you'll forgive me, because I think I was a freshman in college when the strike in '88 happened. So unfortunately, it wasn't at the top of my, you know, on the top of my mind at the time. I do remember it vaguely, but this is a big thing, and I thought it would be, and I'll be really honest with you, I thought this would be solved by now.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that everyone would want to come together, and it's just gotten very nasty.
Yeah, it looks like we're looking at maybe summer going back to the tables. I mean, just going back to the tables, maybe. that the sense you're getting to?
Right, yeah. I'm thinking, yeah, the summer. And that's going to be, if you think about that, that will, I think, eat into the motion pictures.
Oh, yeah.
We haven't seen that yet, but I think come by March or April, because, you know, we talked to all these, we talked to all these guests, and they say, yeah, everything they said, especially the last night's gentleman said, it depends on the strike. You notice that footnote at the end of every conversation we've had the last month, it depends on the strike.
Yeah.
So it will eat in.
Well, stay tuned. I mean, it's going to be interesting to see how this affects something like the Oscars, which is the big kind of sacred industry ceremony
that
every
is.
Year. And the thinking being that the Oscars are good for the industry no matter what.
Right.
But the writers, you know, they aren't granting even clip approval.
Yeah, that caught me off guard. I thought they might have done that, but nope, not at all. And you can't blame them.
Yeah, but the Oscars are such a massive event every year. I mean, we're talking a global audience tuned to that show, so they can't afford not to.
They have to do something, because that's a huge loss if they don't go on. That's an enormous loss.
Well, maybe if Letterman gets his staff together, maybe he can come back and do an Uma Oprah thing that night.
Yeah, I'm sure. You know, wouldn't that be ironic if all the people, that's the man who comes back to save the Oscars? That would be, because what's great about that is that Dave always brings that up and makes fun of it and is great, his wit and everything. He'll tear that apart first.
Yeah, I love Letterman.
Okay, so here's the thing. The People's Choice Award alters its format. But they're not, the show will go on, but they're going to have new ideas how they're going to do it. That's the thing I got so far.
Mm.
There will be no red carpet. Well, okay. I figured that much.
No red carpet.
Yeah, so, we'll see. You know, I don't think anything's going to happen for the rest of the year. I think the first week of January, we'll see what happens with Leno, Letterman, and O'Brien.
Yeah. Well, we're waiting for Mr. Lyman to call in, the director of Enchanted. We're very much looking forward to speaking with him about this great film. And it's going to be, it opened right before Thanksgiving, and it's going to be a big movie for Christmas season as well.
I think so. It was the only, it was the only movie that opened that week. Everything else sort of faltered, sadly, but there was a lot of other good movies. August Rush was good, but that didn't catch on, and The Mist was very good, and sadly, that didn't catch on, but Enchanted did. Enchanted hit a chord with everyone.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We have
you can see why.
Bill Green in the chat room is looking forward to Rambo 4 next year.
I'm looking forward to that, too.
There's a new trailer out.
Yeah, it's a great trailer. I never thought I'd be this excited for a new Rambo movie.
And what is the tagline for this one? A hero doesn't quit, or a warrior doesn't quit, he just reloads.
You can't write this where you can.
Well, it definitely wasn't written by anyone associated with the guild, but what's funny is you laugh, and I laughed.
But we're going to be there.
Then I thought, man, that's perfect.
Yeah.
I mean, that gets me more excited about the film, just that tagline.
Will we have any great dialogue, like in the second one, where what does he say to, I think it's Richard Crenna, he goes, will we be allowed to win this time? You know? But we'll see.
Don't forget who wrote the second one.
Yeah, you know, our man.
Yeah.
Our man wrote it. And that's a line I always remember. Will we be allowed to win this time?
Mr. Cameron. That's right.
Bill Green is absolutely right. The trailer is awesome. Definitely.
Yeah, that looks like a big one. What do you think of this Terminator 4?
I read some stuff over at Chud.com. Yes, I did work a lot today, but I did take a break to post a blog about our show and go to Chud. Christian Bale is going to play John Connor.
Mm-hmm.
That's incredible casting, but it's part of this is just the first film of a new trilogy, I think. So he's not going to be in the first one that much, but he will be in the second one. But it sounds fascinating.
Mm. It does, yeah. Yeah, and it's one of those juicy tidbits of information where you didn't believe it at first.
Right, but it's true. He wants in.
Yeah. So you never know. You never know that the quality of that script. It must be through the roof to get Bale's interest flowing in it.
Yeah. There's another bit of big news, though, very big news, and this, I think this has to do with the failure of the Golden Compass, but New Line has gone ahead, solved all their differences with Peter Jackson, and The Hobbit's coming.
Yes.
And I think that does have to do with the Golden Compass not doing as well as they thought. I think they went ahead and said, okay, look, we need a hit. We need to bring Jackson back.
Yeah, and he's coming back on as an executive producer.
But I heard, now I read a couple things where he's going to direct, but I don't see how he can because he's tied up with so much other things. So I think Sam Raimi's going to direct it from what I've heard over the years.
That'd be nice.
That would be. I have no problem with that. I know there are a lot of people out there who think he did a horrible job with Spider-Man 3, but all right, so I don't blame that entirely on him, and it's hard to keep that momentum going, but he's an awesome director.
Yeah, I don't think he did do a bad job with Spider-Man 3. I mean,
I think it was just too much. They had just too much going on.
Too much stuff in the pot, too many subplots in the pot, you know. And I think that typically superhero movies suffer from that. I think that some way they found a way to avoid that in the second one.
Yeah.
And it felt very seamless in the second one.
It reminded me of the last, not Batman Begins, but Batman and Robin, where they just had too many villains. Remember, Uma Thurman was in it, and they had Bane in it, and they had a lot of villains. It was just too much going on.
Mm-hmm.
And that hurts, but the Sam Raimi is an excellent director, and if he's going to do The Hobbit, that's in good hands as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. Yeah, and I kind of miss his... Because there's two Sam Raimis now. I mean, they both have the same kind of feel and style to them, but I kind of miss the early Sam Raimi. I mean, and the obviously the Evil Dead films, but, you know, A Simple Plan.
Simple Plan's magnificent.
Yeah, and these are movies that kind of get lost in the vernacular when you make a big Spider-Man.
Mm-hmm.
And people
yeah,
don't bother
they do.
To see where you came from, you know.
I also like the one that he did with Hilary Swank.
The Gift.
The Gift. I like that movie. I know a lot of people didn't, but I did like that movie.
Oh, it's a great film. And talk about a cast. I mean, talk about a great cast of character actors.
Oh, wonderful character actors.
Yeah. It's one of those gems from that time that year.
Yes.
And really, like the first kind of one of the first big. I think she'd done Elizabeth. Cate Blanchett had.
Yes. Yeah. That's right. Yes, she had done Elizabeth. That was like really the first big, her first big thing, and
this was a complete 180 from Elizabeth.
Oh yeah, I think this is where people began to see how versatile she was.
Yeah, I think so too. So what else is new on the? We're talking about the man. Bill Green's coming up with some stuff.
I know Bill Green is just the man. He's just like he and John are just like you know, just it's like a howitzer in there. I think the big thing. And I think, you know, I want to talk about it because I watch the trailer a couple times a day, is The Dark Knight.
Yeah.
I'm just really in love with the whole thing again.
It's as excited as I've ever been by a big event movie.
Yeah.
And it looks like such, talk about iconic imagery.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just the trailer alone.
Yeah, I almost wanted to go back and, you know, see it again on the big screen, but I didn't feel like paying to see I Am Legend again, but, you know, I almost, it was just so magnificent to watch on the big screen.
Yeah, it looks like it, and what do you think of the opening, did you get a chance to see the opening 6 minutes?
No, I'm trying to stay away from that not, because I know as soon as I go, I'm going to watch it over and over again. But I almost the other night did, but I was like, no, I want to. I'm trying to. I don't want to burn out before it comes out.
Well, it seems to be heavily kind of influenced by Heat, and
not a bad thing.
No. And of all things, Christopher Nolan has expressed great influence to have been greatly influenced by Heat.
Right.
And it's right there. I mean, it's a bank robbery. William Fichtner's in it, in that scene. A great character actor. Talking about one of our.
Oh, he is.
And it's an exciting scene, but I have a theory that it's not going to be the first scene in the movie, like they say.
Okay. Hmm.
I think it might have been something exclusively shot for this kind of marketing.
Right.
Remember, Spider-Man, I think it was the first Spider-Man, where it was a World Trade Center scene. Where the robbers came in and they ended up spun in the web between the two towers.
Right.
Now, that was obviously, I mean, they pulled posters and they pulled that trailer because of the tragedy
right.
of 9/11. But I think I recall Sam Raimi saying in an interview that it was never going to be in the finished product anyway. He never intended it to be a film. I think that we're talking about something similar here.
That's possible. I wouldn't put that past them. Let me ask you this. When you watch Memento and Insomnia and even his first film, I Like a Lot, Following, did you have any idea that Nolan had this in him? It never dawned on me.
Well, he's a guy that, you know, obviously Memento was incredibly ingenious in its approach. He found kind of a new twist on telling a story that a lot of people found fascinating and
right.
stylish. And then he goes and he does Insomnia, where, you know, everything that's hip and different about Memento, that genre of film, is very by the book on Insomnia, but really, really magnificently so.
Right.
Because this is a tried and true genre, he's saying, with Insomnia. These conventions work if they're done well and approached with the right mentality. And I think that he did that with Insomnia. And I think his focus on the moral struggle in Insomnia, which I think is unique in that it's a whodunit that happens
right.
through. It's no longer a whodunit. Actually, it's not a whodunit. You know who did it all along.
Right. No, you do.
But the cop does too, and so that it focuses more energy on the morality of that lead cop character, Pacino's character, and I think that it's one of the best Pacino performances from the past 15 years too.
Yes,
I think he's wonderful with actors.
Oh, I think everyone actually in that film does a really good job. I was really impressed with that film. For a remake, it holds its own, and
yeah, and I think that watching the original because it's remade from a Swedish
right with Skellen Skarsgård
yeah and which is a very good film in its own right and it's very spare. It's not a lot of flourishes emotionally or minimal, as far as I can recall, like minimal dialogue. It's very very spare kind of filmmaking,
right,
where less is more kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But the American version, what Nolan does with it is, which is, I guess, the American way, is he amps up the internal drama.
Right.
And the questions, the morality of these characters and how they're flip sides of one another.
He did a wonderful job. I remember when that came out. And, you know, so it was like Pacino was very good, Robin Williams very good, everyone was very good about it. It was really, you know, Chris Dolan. And I know a lot of the critics kind of came down on it, but I thought it was great.
Yeah, I think the critics were generally very favorable to it, though.
When I mean critics, usually, Jamie, and you, and this is, I think, before Rotten Tomatoes or before I started, I'm usually talking about, like, the Post and the Times and the Journal on a Friday morning, get up before work, and they're usually, oh, this movie blows. You know, that's what I'm talking about when I mean critics, so you'll forgive me. I need to specify that better.
Yeah, but I think if you look at Memento and Insomnia, I think that's a great 1-2 combo in how you can kind of twist conventional genre movies on their head a little bit, while still maintaining what is essential
mm-hmm.
about those genres.
Oh, absolutely. That's a very good point.
I don't put anything past Nolan. I think he's one of the absolute brightest directors that we have, and I'm not willing to bet that he's incapable of doing anything.
No, I think you're absolutely right.
He has a passion for Batman, and we're seeing that morality of the Batman character coming out too.
Even in this trailer, we're seeing that.
Yeah, and playing it as realistically as possible.
I thought what was great about Batman Begins is, and this is Roy, I think, sort of like almost a compliment to Michael Keaton, because I thought Michael Keaton as Bruce Wayne was one of the highlights of those first two Tim Burton films. But I thought it was a really smart move that we really get to know Bruce Wayne first.
Right.
And we get to see how he becomes, how he evolves into Batman. And I thought it was really good. Like, the first half of the movie, it's really about Bruce Wayne for once.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was a brilliant touch.
It really was. And you're hearing, at least from my point of view, you're hearing from someone that's not crazy about comic books.
No, but you give them, actually, lately, though, you've changed your tune on that. You've been very more open-minded about them.
Well, I try to be open-minded about movies, but comic books aren't comic book films aren't the first things I get excited
about. No. But you, as someone who knows that about you, I would say in the year that I've known you, that you've opened up to that genre more than I think you ever would have before.
Yeah. I mean, I'm still not gonna, you know, flock to any comic book movie.
You're not going. I know you're not going to see the Hulk or things like that opening day.
Right.
I would be surprised if I got a call from you that Friday when the Hulk comes out. Oh, man, I just went to see the midnight show of the Hulk.
But the package itself is what sells me. And you're talking about the package. Talk about the Hulk. I mean, we talk about all the movies coming out this summer. We talk about the big event films like Indiana Jones and what else? The Dark Knight.
The Dark Knight, Iron Man. Speed Racer, Prince Caspian. I think we have a Harry Potter movie towards the end of the summer.
We're missing the Hulk.
We are missing the Hulk, and that's...
And I think that a lot of people overlook the Hulk. First of all, it hasn't really gotten any... I think they're waiting until the fervor kind of dies down for these other reveals from these other movies.
Right.
But we're talking about Edward Norton playing the Hulk, which is as exciting a concept as... And different as a concept as, you know...
You wouldn't associate him with that. Because he, you know, he were for a while there... Because it seemed like for a while he was shunning the big-budget movies. Like, he did the remake of The Italian Job because Paramount made him do it, is a story I heard. He wasn't eager to do that.
It was a contractual thing.
And when I saw he was attached to the Hulk, I thought it was a joke.
You know, it's funny because we covered the Sarasota Film Festival for the show a few months ago, in April. And he was a guest honoree there.
Right.
And he was doing a Q&A, and there was an audience in attendance, and he was there in Sarasota, and then he left. And the next morning, it broke that he was playing the Hulk.
Wow.
Yeah. So it felt like a missed opportunity. If we had somehow had insider information, and we could get it.
Right.
You know, doing the show now, I look at everything as kind of like, is this an opportunity that I seize upon or that I missed, you know?
Right. No, but it's the oddest bit. For me, at least, it's odd casting. Knowing what I know about Ed Norton, it just seems like that's the last person I would see in that type of role.
Well, it has to have, that part must have a really, be really central, centered in some sort of cerebral, emotional, psychological basis. And I think that a lot of so-called superhero movies or comic book movies are. I mean, they're all tortured in some way. And they all
right.
have some kind of thing that they're working through, and their powers help them through that or inhibit them from doing that. I think that's the kind of struggle that he's probably responding to from the Hulk.
Right. Well,
so
isn't that there in the Ang Lee film, though? You have a lot of philosophical issues that are dealt with. It may not be coherent, but it's you know, one of the complaints of that movie was that Ang Lee almost made too smart a comic book movie for its own good. And I have mixed feelings about the Hulk. I don't hate it. I don't love it, but I don't hate it.
Right.
If what you say is true, and I do think that would be his attraction to the material. I'm curious to see how it plays out again. Maybe they'll do it better this time. I don't know.
Well, and I think that it was interesting having Ang Lee. I think Ang Lee is one of our most interesting directors.
Talk about versatile.
You give him, and this is his challenge, you give him an American, like a typically American genre, the ice storm.
Yeah.
You know, a Midwestern, or I can't remember where
it's on New England, but I want to say New England.
Yeah, like a real, like,
great book, great
American
book, great
family.
Film.
Criterion's releasing that in March in a special edition.
Are you going to buy that for me?
Of course. And then
I had to buy my own copy of Tulane Blacktop yesterday, but.
Oh, did you really?
Yes,
and then,
I did.
Of course, as American as it gets, the Western with Brokeback Mountain. And then Ang Lee does he did the Hulk as well before that, and that's.
And then he does Lust Caution after Brokeback Mountain, and
he said, let's make a comic book movie. I mean, let's not make a comic book movie in the style of, you know, Dick Tracy necessarily. That all the colors, all the rich, bright, vibrant colors spell comic book.
Right.
He actually broke it down, you know, broke down this frame.
He
in segments, yeah, like you would read a comic book, you would read that movie shot for shot.
Yes.
he said that I think he wanted to do that more, but he had to kind of tone it down. But it's always fascinating when a director with foreign sensibilities comes in and directs an inherently American genre
yes.
piece.
Yeah, I mean, Fritz Lang did that a lot, and a lot of these great directors do it. And Ang Lee, he did Sense and Sensibility, The Ice Storm. I mean, you go on and on, and each film is different.
Yeah, I mean, talk about a chameleon filmmaker.
Yeah, he's incredible.
Yeah, he really is. So I'm of the opinion that Kevin Lima will not be joining us tonight.
I don't think so. I'm sorry about that.
His interview segment was scheduled for 9:30 tonight, Eastern Time. And we'd gone back and forth with the publicist, and we'll try to reschedule. But that's if you have not seen Enchanted yet, and you're with family this Christmas, I would definitely say that's the movie to go to. For the whole family, it's a wonderful. It puts a smile on your face. That movie does, and so few movies now do. And if you know Christmas time, it's the time to see that kind of film.
It is.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a good time to see a horror film, really, with the family.
Well, I'm not going with my family, but I'm taking my older brother to see Alien versus Predator on Christmas Day.
Oh, that does open Christmas Day, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
Speaking of Alien versus Predator, if you check our archives, we do have an interview we did several months ago with a cinematographer.
That's right.
Alien versus Predator, and he gave us the low down low. What term would it be?
Let's say the down low. No, not the down low. No, the low down. Let's just say low down. Let's play it safe.
Yeah, he gave us that on that film. So we got good advanced word on that movie. Also included in our archive shows, we have interviews with Brian De Palma and the cast of Redacted, composers like Howard Shore and Mark Mancina and Mark Isham and John Ottman, and we love composers on this show. And coming up, we do have John Sayles this Sunday. Legendary independent filmmaker John Sayles.
You couldn't ask for a better director to have on.
Oh, absolutely. And then a complete 180 in January. Well, I don't, just in terms of genres.
Yeah.
Dolph Lundgren.
Let's break you.
Will be with us. And you also need to stay closely tuned to the blog announcements and bulletin postings and that sort of thing, and the Blog Talk Radio announcements concerning our Sundance series that will take place next month.
Before we go on, there is one other movie we should probably talk about for January.
What's that?
Cloverfield.
Yeah.
I've been reading, there's a review at Ain't It Cool News today or yesterday. Someone has seen it, and they said the monster footage is unlike anything they had ever seen before. I don't know what to make of that, being a monster movie buff myself, but it sounds like they might have a real movie. It is definitely a hype machine, but it sounds like they have something here.
Yeah, I think so too.
I mean, that was a great trailer in front of Transformers.
It was, and it very smart marketing there.
Yeah,
because it was the kind of movie that everybody said, "What is that?" You know,
everyone went home that night to.
Yeah, it wasn't
online.
You didn't feel like you saw the whole movie or had a grasp of what this movie was. You just were starved to know
right.
more about it. And that's brilliant marketing there. But now, you know, you have all the big event films in the summer. You have The Dark Knight, you have Indiana Jones, which I'm willing to bet that teaser trailer will be on National Treasure this weekend.
Do you think National Treasure, or do you think, let me ask you this, because it's Paramount, Cloverfield, because Star Trek teaser trailer...
No, I think the audiences are going to be in the theater in droves for the holiday. I don't think they're going to miss that.
Okay, all right. If you say
I'm going to
go see National Treasure 2 based on that.
That's what I'm thinking.
Okay, well, I still want to see National Treasure 2, but I'm going now with that expectation. So
absolutely. Yeah, well, don't hold me to it.
I'm not insider information. I wouldn't do that to you.
But you have all these big event films coming out in the summer, and now Cloverfield is kind of... Now the movie on everyone's lips is The Dark Knight. And then next week, I'm sure it'll be Indiana Jones. So Cloverfield comes out in 2 weeks, in 3 weeks.
Yeah.
And it's got they posted the first 5 minutes online.
Yeah, I watched that.
There is a danger of...
Overexposure.
Too much too soon.
Mm-hmm.
you know, even though they don't do a great reveal in that teaser trailer, it's just enough to pique interest. And everybody's been talking about it every day for the past few months since that trailer premiered. And it's overkill before it actually comes out. I mean,
do you fear that with The Dark Knight 2, though, the way they're posting that, the 6 minutes?
I think they need to, well, I've already given my opinion on the 6 minutes. I don't think it's the 6 minutes that'll be in the film.
Right.
But
do you
think they need to tone it down
for a while?
Now that they made the splash for the posters and the trailer, I think they need to quiet it down until April.
That's a good plan.
Yeah. Don't make the movie, you know, don't make the actual experience of seeing the movie secondary.
Right.
Yeah, and that's kind of what it's starting to feel like with Cloverfield.
That's great. That's actually really great advice for anyone.
Thank you.
You want the movie to be first and foremost.
Thank you. Yeah. And you can pay for my advisory services.
Great.
Okay, we're expecting, for the Kings of the Evening, we're expecting a few guests to call in any moment now. And when they both come up, we'll turn it to that, but big movies and a big exciting year for Sundance this year, or
awesome.
Next year. I mean, it takes place mid-January. I printed out their schedule. It was 102 pages.
You printed that out?
Of course I did.
I would have to do that at work.
That's where I did it.
Oh, you slice.
That's right. I printed that out, and just an amazing lineup of films. Michael Keaton, one of our favorites, has directed and stars in a movie called The Merry Gentlemen.
I've heard good things about that so far.
Yeah, but for Michael Keaton to take his place behind the camera, that's very unique. That must be a great project.
I would say. I mean, he's definitely someone who's still in the game. There was the year before, there was a movie that he was in called Game 6.
Yes.
And it's an interesting film. It's the first film I think I've ever seen based on a Don DeLillo story. It was interesting, but I always like to see Michael Keaton because I think we like him a lot, but I think he's a truly undervalued actor.
I think he has so much talent. We do not see enough of him. He's one of those actors where I want to see you more, man. Clean and Sober.
Yeah, I know. You love that one. And that's
how could you find a performance better than that one?
Right.
I mean, an incredible performance. And our next, both of our guests are on the line and ready to go.
Okay, let's go.
Let's get started. Kings of the Evening paints a vivid portrait of urban life during the Great Depression era, where one of the biggest challenges was to maintain a sense of dignity and self-respect in an environment designed to decimate the human spirit. This beautiful and incredibly moving film is written and directed with great sensitivity and passion by Andrew P. Jones, and features an outstanding cast that includes Lynn Whitfield, Tyson Beckford, Bruce McGill, James Russo, Reginald Dorsey, and Glenn Turman. As the character of Clarence Brown, Mr. Turman delivers a heartbreaking performance, adding yet another deeply felt and versatile characterization to his roster of great work, which includes roles in films like Gremlins, Deep Cover, How Stella Got Her Groove Back, Men of Honor, and Sahara, and television series like Murder, She Wrote, A Different World, and The Wire, for which he received an Image Award nomination for Outstanding Supporting Actor in a Drama Series. It is a great pleasure to welcome to the show tonight writer-director Andrew P. Jones and actor Glenn Turman. Gentlemen, are you both with us?
I'm here. This is Andrew.
Mr. Turman, are you with us? I see his line up there, so hopefully he'll come on soon. Mr. Jones, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Thank you
for having us.
And Mr. Turman, are you there on the line? Something might be wrong with this line. You might need to, I see his line up here, he might need to hang up and call back in again. Maybe there's a connection that's on the fritz or something. But Mr. Jones, a fantastic movie, Kings of the Evening. I was incredibly moved by it.
Thank you.
And I'm interested to know, first of all, how you got started into the business before this project and how the idea for this project came along.
Well, I actually have about 23 years in the film industry and television industry. And I've kind of changed careers over the 23 years. I actually got into the business doing special effects, doing makeup effects and props and puppets. And that kind of morphed into some producing and directing. I produced a children's show for a few years, and then I got into post-production and editing. So my background finally, you know, all the things that I did in my career really lent itself to directing, because
right.
the director really needs to know all the different crafts.
Yeah. So how did the idea for Kings of the Evening come about for you?
I actually have a writing partner who is very close to me. He is my father. And
is that Robert?
Yeah.
Okay.
Phenomenal writer, very well-published author of novels. But he's always had a passion for screenwriting, and he's a very, very, very good screenwriter. Mm. And he brought this idea to me, and he and I kind of worked on the script. And where it came from was a newspaper article that he had read about the Oswankas in South Africa.
Okay.
And that is a group of men who, during the day, they toil in the mines, but at night, you know, on Saturday evening, they put together these very fine suits, and they compete against each other for the man that has the best suit and the man that has the most style and grace. And it's all about dignity and self-respect.
Yeah.
So he took that idea and said it in America during the Depression, when, you know, socioeconomic times were kind of similar. And he grew up during the Depression, so he writes a lot about what he knows about. And that's how it started.
I think Mr. Terman's back on the line. Let me see if this is his line. Mr. Terman?
Hello, can you hear me?
I can hear
you.
You
can hear you.
Loud and clear.
Okay, great.
Thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Great.
I was just asking Mr. Jones about the beginnings of this idea for Kings of the Evening. Mr. Terman, when you first received the script,
yes.
What about the script struck you?
Well, you know, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, great, great. It's such a character-driven piece in a time that's you know, so much flash and so much all the computer tricks
yeah.
are used to tell stories, and this was just simply good, clean writing, and simply good, clean lines to characters. Without any tricks, and that's what struck me about it.
Yeah, and Mr. Jones, when you're writing these roles, were you picturing certain actors in your mind? And was Mr. Terman on your mind from the get go with this character? As you're
yeah, you know, I think every writer has certain people that they write to. It just kind of makes the process a little bit easier. Glenn was one of the first people that was actually on board the project, and at first, I wasn't sure, to be quite honest, because, I mean, I know his body of work, and he's one of, you know, the most talented actors working today, but this role was so different.
Mm.
And I think the one thing that people are going to be surprised at with Glenn is, you know, typically they see him as the colonel and the detective and the doctor.
Sure.
But this role was so different. And, I mean, this is about a guy, this role is a man that is down and out, down on his luck. It required comedy, drama, physical comedy. And I think that's the one thing that's going to surprise people the most, and it really speaks to Glenn's genius, is he is an incredible physical comedic actor.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you. I'll give you that $5 I promised you.
No, I mean, truly. I mean, he is a modern-day Buster Keaton, and I think Buster Keaton was an absolute genius.
Oh, wow.
I was just blown away daily by what Glenn would bring to it.
He's incredibly...
incredible actor.
You're incredibly moving in the film, Mr. Terman, and your character, there's obviously... this had to have attracted you. There's an arc there to your character.
Right, absolutely.
And I wanted to ask you about a couple of scenes in particular.
Okay.
There's a scene at the bar where you're talking about how that kind of environment strips you of your dignity, where you feel like, do I even exist?
Right.
And I thought watching that scene that's the movie. That's the theme of the movie right there in that scene. And did that scene strike you as the centerpiece kind of moment for this character?
Well, yeah, I think that that really sums up this guy, and it sums up, like you said, it sums up the times. You know, it's what those times were about, and it's what you know, the awful thing of becoming invisible.
Yeah.
You know, being stripped of your dignity to the point of where you're invisible, and that was definitely pointed out in that scene. But it's, you know, like, again, it gets to the writing. You can't have a, you know, I didn't make any of that up. You know, it was on the page, you know, and it was just a joy to have the opportunity to breathe life into it, you know, which is what our jobs are.
So, Andrew, you collaborated on the script with your father. I'm interested in how that collaboration works. I mean, you know.
Actually, beautifully. I mean, what I generally bring to it is a director's sensibility.
Mm-hmm.
And we just have a very easy time working together. We just have a very easy...
Well, his dad is so cool. I mean, he's just one of the coolest, most gracious men, gentlemen, that I've had the opportunity to work with in a long time. And he's so... The thing that's so great about it is his excitement, Andrew, his excitement about being in this, in the business, and seeing his baby, or your guys' baby, come to life. You know, he was just like a kid in the candy store, which was great to watch.
Yeah, he loves movies. He's always loved movies. He, you know, remembers as a kid in the 30s sitting in the movie theater all day for 5 cents. It's a very magical thing to him, and he was there every day of production. And, it was just the greatest. It was the greatest part of this whole experience, was getting the chance to work with him.
Wow, that's fantastic. And I think you can kind of feel that in the movie, too, because the movie, I mean, it's about a family of sorts, a group of people that have to stick together.
Yeah, absolutely. It's definitely about overcoming the odds, and that when things are bad and times are down, you've got each other, and you've got to turn to each other. And you know, the environment on the set was very much the same thing. And I've often said that the experience behind the camera kind of mirrored what was happening in the story. It's really about, I mean, getting any independent film done is a miracle.
Mm.
You have to, a lot of odds that you have to overcome.
Well, tell me about that, because I know that this is obviously an independent production, and it's a period piece, which is even more challenging. Well, tell
yeah,
me about
people
this.
Said I was crazy, you know. It's a period piece, what are you doing? You know, that's so hard to do. But you know what? We just had this amazing, dedicated crew that every day just brought something new and something special to it.
They were great.
And the whole cast, I mean, for my first feature, I have a dream cast. I mean, from, you know, Glenn to Lynn, Tyson is going to surprise everybody in this film.
Yes,
Reginald Dorsey, Lenata Washington, who's a relative newcomer, but, you know, gave a tremendous performance opposite Tyson as the love interest. And even some of the smaller roles, you know, Lou Myers, Willard Pugh, who played Harpo in Color Purple.
Mm.
He had a very small part in the film, but... Boy, he just...
Did he do, I mean, a class, a textbook example of what, of there is no small part, you know?
Yeah, that's exactly it. And it feels like a terrific ensemble. You can feel that as you're watching it. Mr. Terman, another scene that I wanted to discuss with you, and I wanted to get your feelings on working on this scene and with this actress in particular. One of the most amazing scenes in the film for me is you're sitting at the piano with Lynn Whitfield, where you're revealing parts of your past that you didn't know about one another previously.
Right.
Let me just say real quick, one of the fun things that I do in my life is I like to quiz people that have seen the film, and I always ask them, what is your favorite scene in the film?
Yeah.
And I will tell you, 99% of them say it's the piano scene.
Is that right?
Absolutely.
It would have to be. It feels like it happens after something very... very dramatic occurs in the film, and it feels like a major kind of discovery, and you can sense the life and the confidence starting to rebuild in your character. It's an amazing scene. Tell me about working with Lynn Whitfield on that.
Well, that's the key right there, you know. I've always admired Lynn. I'm a fan of Lynn's work, you know, and I know her work, and you know, you get into a. It's like playing ball. It's like playing baseball with a wonderful pitcher and catcher, you know. And you know that she's going to catch the ball and she's going to fire it right back at you, you know, and she trusts that I'm going to catch it and throw it back. So that's what it becomes. It becomes a dance. It becomes a game that you, with two people or three people, with Andrew there as well, knowing that the ball is going to be caught and thrown back, you know.
Yeah.
And that's just what it was about, you know. It was just doing the dance that we love to do, you know, as actors and actresses. And she's just, there are no finer actresses around than, in my opinion, than Lynn Whitfield.
Yeah, what's very interesting about that role is that we were talking to a number of actresses, and Glenn kept saying, because Glenn was on early, he kept saying, what about Lynn Whitfield? And at first I thought, she's too beautiful. Who's going to believe that she's
true.
Down and out? She's
right.
This gorgeous, gorgeous woman. Who's going to believe that? But he kept saying, well, what about Lynn? What about Lynn? And we went through all kinds of variations. You know, Pam Grier really wanted to play the part, and that was a possibility. And Loretta Devine, which is a very different type. And and ironically, we end up with Lynn Whitfield, who Gwen recommended from the beginning.
Well, good thing Glenn was right all along.
Well, I'm just glad that first of all, I'm glad that Andrew feels that I was right in that choice, and that he had the confidence to go with her, and that he's so elated with what she did. I knew that she would be, but you know, you got to understand, and I definitely understood, being a director as well, that you know, the position that Andrew was in, you know, entrusting coming out this first time, first of all, there's so many things that that you're skeptical of, or at least you know might have your guard up about, and hoping will go the right way for you, and so, oh, there's somebody calling, but I'm not going to answer them right. but to have it go that way, you know, and to have him, have Lynn do work her magic, and to see the smile on Andrew's face, you know, as he would watch her work, you know, I'd sneak a peek at Andrew, you know, when I was up to the side, and he'd have this big smile on his face, you know, I'd say, yeah.
Yeah. After the fact, now I can't imagine anybody else playing that part.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm wondering, this is your first film, how daunting that must have been as a director, your first film as a feature director. How daunting must that have been to find yourself in the company of all these great actors that you'd assembled, and how did you kind of overcome your first day fears? Because I can't imagine not having them.
Well, you know, I mean, I have directed over the years. I just haven't directed a feature before.
Right.
And yeah, there's a lot of pressure on me, and I have all these great actors showing up, and I've never directed a feature before. But they, you know, sometimes it was a little period of just kind of getting to know how I work and how they work, and developing that trust. And I think in pretty short order, they tended to trust me. And
now, was there a rehearsal period involved in
the
film?
No, we did not have rehearsal. I mean, that's the thing about, you know, we shot the whole film in 28 days. We did not have budget for a rehearsal period. I see the benefit of that, and, you know, next time I would really, really push for that. So typically, I mean, and that's where having such a great cast, such an experienced cast, really paid off, because, yeah, they would have liked rehearsal time as well, but they're so good and they're so talented that it wasn't too difficult for them to just step on the set and just be brilliant.
That's just it, because there's such a feeling of community in the movie, and I thought certainly they had a rehearsal period where they had an opportunity to warm up and create this kind of atmosphere together.
No rehearsal.
No,
oh, that's incredible.
Rehearsal.
That's incredible. So what are your plans for the film? I know that is it still in post? Is it still going through editing? Or?
We are, no. I mean, we're at the last couple of things. We're just trying to get it finished up by the end of January. We were chosen as the closing night film in the Pan-African Film Festival in Los Angeles.
Wow.
A very great honor. And so that now is our deadline. That film festival is in February, mid-February. So the push is on just to get it finished. And everybody has been very gracious, and everyone is on board helping us out. Because we ran out of money. You know, so now we're relying on favors, but it will get done. It's 95% of the way there. We're just finishing up the last few elements, and then we'll be ready to show it.
It's a fantastic, wonderful movie. And before you guys leave, I want to know, what do you hope that people take away from this film? Glenn, if you'd like to start.
Well, you know, there's a spirit that this film is about, you know. It's about the human condition and the human spirit. And it's about something that, especially right now, I think it correlates with our times right now in terms of where the country is, as well as where I think the world is, in terms of trying to maintain a sense of human dignity about ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
I think that this film, in its own small way, taps into what that is about and what that source is and how important that particular striving or accomplishment is to accomplish being aware of your human contribution,
mm-hmm.
you know. And it sounds deep and all that kind of stuff, maybe, or maybe it doesn't.
No, it's life. I mean, that's
that's where we are now, and that's what these times are, you know. And everybody, I think, across the nation is trying to tap into that which connects us to each other.
Yeah.
And
and it's getting more and more difficult. I mean,
exactly.
The world is more and more designed to kind of dislocate us from each other.
Exactly.
So how about you, Andrew? What do you hope people take away from this film?
You know, I think Glenn's right. It's really a film about the human spirit, and it's about surviving. Survival was the one word that we've always used from the beginning.
Mm.
Survival in production, survival on screen. I mean, it's really about five people surviving, and it's a hopeful film. And one thing that's really surprised me is that typically when you put something out like this, you get a mixed reaction. You know, some people love it, some people hate it. You know, that's the nature of films,
right,
and of art. I've been very surprised and very pleased that almost across the board, everybody walks away from this film feeling good. And that's the thing that I think we've been able to deliver, is a film that just makes people feel good and feel hopeful.
Let me tell you, I get sent so many movies every week to view, and when I put your film on, and I was just so incredibly moved by it, and I felt so thankful. I mean, what a great film! It's just a gem of a movie, and you hear Great Depression, and obviously there are portraits of great despair and heartbreak that occurred during that time, but it's also a very joyous film, too.
Wow.
Very heartwarming, and I hope that everyone out there gets an opportunity to see it. Are you looking for distribution, obviously, I would think?
Yeah, we do. We've got somebody out there shopping it around, and we've got a lot of very reputable distributors who are considering it. Sadly, we're still in a category that the industry finds difficulty with, and that's that if it's considered an African-American film, there's automatically this kind of, it's a hard sell attitude.
Yeah.
I never understand it, because one, it's just a human film.
It's a human film, yes, exactly.
And two, even if you do want to put it in the category of being an African-American film, that's a great market. It's a strong market.
Awesome market.
Wonderful market.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't know why Hollywood continues to shy away from it, and they're afraid of it for some reason. But yeah, so people are still trying to make up their minds, and I think they're waiting to see what other people think. But you know, we will get there.
Well,
it's all about the human spirit.
I want to say my thanks to you for picking out our film to put on your airwaves and to recommend as highly as you have just spoken about it. That says a lot about you, and I'm so happy that you have chosen this film, and can't wait to meet you and wish you all the best with your station and everything.
It is an honor for me to do so, sir.
It's an honor to talk to both of you.
Anything that I can do, if you guys get to a place where you have some distribution leads and you want to share it with us, please come back and join us.
Yeah, we would love to.
I'd love to know the journey of this film, and I encourage everyone to do it. Is there a website that they can go to, first of all?
We don't have a website built right now, but it is on MySpace.
Okay.
MySpace.com/KingsOfTheEvening, all one word.
Okay. And we will put that in. You are one of our friends on MySpace, so we'll put you in our top friends. So
okay.
You can be easily accessed through the Movie Geeks United page. So,
great.
Gentlemen, thank you both
thank
so
you
much for
much.
Being with us.
Thank you.
It's been a great pleasure, and I hope to talk to you both soon.
Absolutely.
All right.
Bye-bye. Bye.
Hey, Andrew.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go right ahead.
What's that?
Talk to you later.
Okay.
That is Andrew Jones and Glenn Turman. I'm telling you, Jerry, this is a fantastic, heartwarming movie.
Will you send it to me?
Yes, I'll send it to you.
Thank you.
And that's why it is discouraging when you have a movie that is so human, just like he said, and they're trying to wrap it in a little box and say it's for this group of audience. You know, it's for everyone.
Yeah.
I mean. It's
but that's,
you know,
a great mark. That's one of the great markets. That I can't believe Hollywood still doesn't understand how to tap into that market.
Look at the number one opening weekends. Look at the number one opening weekend around America.
I don't care.
Year.
You know, people are always like, you know, like Tyler Perry or something. I don't care who you are. Tyler Perry's a genius. He figured out how to do this on his own,
right?
Without the studio system. And I don't care who you are. If you're an aspiring filmmaker, find out what he did. And that goes, I mean, I hate when people categorize films, and especially the Hollywood does that. They don't understand, you know, the evidence is right there in front of them, and
look,
they don't.
I know nothing of the Great Depression. I know nothing of the struggles of the Great Depression. But I'm just a white kid from Florida.
Yeah, I'm a white kid.
But I watched
Urban Punk.
I watched this film. I immediately identified with every character on that screen. It's human. I mean, we're all human.
It's universal, and I think that, you know, it's what William Goldman said, no one in Hollywood, they don't know anything. It's still true.
Well, yeah, I think some filmmakers, you know, and obviously he knew when he was putting it together that these were universal themes.
Yeah, I don't see this. There's just from what I heard in the last half hour, there's a huge market for this film.
Yeah,
huge, and I really do hope it gets a theatrical release, a wide theatrical release. From what I've heard, it sounds like it deserves it.
Yeah, it really does. Kings of the Evening. So we will do that tonight. We will put their page up on our MySpace top friends. So if you visit us, click on their profile. It's an exceptional film, and anytime it comes anywhere near you, you should go check it out.
Yeah, definitely.
We're waiting for John Gaspard, the author of Fast, Cheap, and Written That Way, which is the sequel to his book Fast, Cheap, and Under Control.
Mm.
Series of great books, by the way. Q&A books, really, with top directors that started making these low-budget indie films.
Right.
And that's how they got their name. We're talking about, let me just look through and like point one out. What George Romero, Stuart Gordon with Reanimator. There's a section here, Roger Corman, the granddaddy.
All important iconic names.
Yeah, Robert Rodriguez.
Yeah, I mean,
you gotta love a guy that sells his body to science to.
Yeah, that book that he wrote, Rebel Without a Crew, essential reading for anyone.
Yeah, Jon Favreau, Swingers.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's a real guerrilla filmmaking kind of. Of course, Kevin Smith, one of the most notable.
Yeah, these are all
decade. And John Sayles is in here too.
It's interesting. John Sayles is like just one of the most fascinating directors that we have today, because he still, you know, he goes out there, he goes and raises the money for his films. He'll go write a script for a big Hollywood studio movie,
yeah,
and he'll use that to finance his own movie. And he just, every time out of the gate, it's just something new and unique.
Yeah, it is, and he will not compromise his vision.
Never. I don't think he's ever compromised.
Yeah. I think I saw a call earlier. It was a New York area code, and I'm willing to bet that was Kevin Lima. But we scheduled his interview for 9:30, and I think there might have been a mix-up where it was originally scheduled for 10, and then last week they confirmed they were okay with 9:30.
Mm.
So that might explain that. Either way, two more guests tonight, two more guest segments. We also have a special treat for you. In this last interview segment we're going to do with Michael Mays, the co-star of National Treasure 2, we're going to play you the trailer on the radio, in crisp stereo sound.
Wow, I feel like that's cool. That's going to be very interesting. That should be cool.
Yes, yes. It
should I go to YouTube and sync it up with the video? Or
you know, everyone out there, if you love movies, you obviously have an active imagination. So I think you can. The listeners out there can use it.
I think so. Yeah. I mean, I have no doubt about that. Now that's a fascinating. These movies are fascinating. You know, they take advantage of the whole. I guess it's with the Da Vinci Code and the Raiders of the Lost Ark. The whole
sure.
The track, you know, looking for clues and everything. It's fascinating stuff. I mean, the way they incorporate the conspiracy theories, especially in this one, it seems like it's a lot of conspiracy theories.
Yes. And, you know, it's the kind of movie that Jerry Bruckheimer does just exceptionally well.
This is what he does.
Yeah, he's exceptional at it. And the first one is just incredibly entertaining. I mean, there's no denying it. And
right.
This one, obviously, I think has more of an international flair to it. It's, you know, it's a sequel, so it's more kind of...
They kidnapped the president. At least that's
yeah.
what it's in the trailer. They kidnap the president.
Where do you go from there, really?
I don't know what you do after that.
Yeah, so we're waiting for Mr. Gaspard to call in so we can discuss his duo of phenomenal books on low-budget independent filmmaking. So what would you like to talk about in the meantime, Jerry?
What I would like to talk about, you know, they brought up Lynn Whitfield, and, you know, she's awesome just any way you want to talk about her, but she was great in Eve's Bayou.
Yeah, yeah. One of the great kind of, if you read Roger Ebert at all, he's very enthusiastic about that movie. He's saying, look, this is one of the classic films of the past decade.
I agree with him.
Yeah.
That was a great film. Also, one of those great, like, Samuel Jackson performances
mm-hmm.
where he's not, you know, overacting, he's not cursing in every other line, and he's wonderful in that.
Yeah.
And she was also good in that one with Martin Lawrence. Was a Thin Line Between Love and Hate.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought she was very good in that. She's done a lot of TV work, but it's always good to hear her name because she's, you know, you just don't hear enough about her. I think so.
Yeah, but it's always nice when you see her in films. And,
yes.
Know, like an old friend.
Like an old friend. That's right.
Ah, old friend. How have you been?
And Mr. Turman was just awesome. I mean, he has such a wonderful voice, as John was saying in the chat room. His voice is a very commanding, very passionate voice. And
I would buy whatever he's selling.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, definitely. So that was
and great
pleasure.
In The Wire. I mean, he's, you know, I don't know if you've seen The Wire.
Oh, it's one of those things I'm looking forward to in January.
It's one of these landmark shows, and every time you read about it, you hear, why aren't you watching this show?
Yeah, why aren't people watching it? Because it's very engrossing. I didn't start watching it until like the third season.
Yeah.
But it's very engrossing.
I'm trying to catch up, but I just received season 4 in the mail this week.
Would you stop saying everything you get in the mail?
Well, it's important to the show because...
I know it's important to the show, but...
and because people, our listeners benefit from it as well. Because
I know, I completely understand. I'm just like, you know...
You know what I got in the mail yesterday?
I know exactly what you got in the mail yesterday.
Yes. The Zodiac Director's Cut.
Yeah, I know, yeah.
And Eastern Promises. And what that means is we'll be able to deliver reviews of these DVDs prior to the release dates for all of our listeners out there.
That's right. That would be good.
It's all about you guys.
It really is. And both of those are superb movies.
It's why we suffer and toil watching... the director's cut of a film like Zodiac. Only one of the best films of the year.
Instead of going in sick for work.
It's all for you guys. So, great show so far. We apologize for Mr. Lima. We had obviously a great segment planned for him. And we're still awaiting a call from author John Gaspard.
Right.
About these books. And then we'll close off tonight with National Treasure 2 actor Michael Mays. It just turned out, you know, this evening, I think it's because it's pre-Christmas.
Yeah, you got to remember, this is a crazy week for everyone.
Yeah, I think because it's pre-Christmas, everyone chose to book tonight's show.
Right.
So we ended up with a 2.5-hour show, and I apologize for the the segments where there haven't been guests that we've been expecting. But hopefully all of our people in the chat room and all the people that have listened throughout the night have gotten something out of this. If you have any opinions on any upcoming films,
yeah, please,
you
want to
ask questions or make comments
you
about
previews. Call.
Yeah, give us
please
a call.
Please call.
718-508-9477. This show is just as much yours as it is ours.
Yeah, it is the fan show.
We would love to hear from you. If you have a passion for movies, we're going to talk to you.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. There's a lot of it's really interesting. It seems like they do save the best for last this year. It seems like Charlie Wilson's War and obviously There Will Be Blood is the one which you and I probably won't see until January.
Right.
But those are they save the very best for last, it seems.
Oh.
And I'm very excited to see both of those films.
Yeah, I've been reading more and more about There Will Be Blood.
Yeah, I just got to stop reading about it because I just want to see it at this point.
Yeah. Quite an actor, Daniel Day-Lewis. And it's good that he doesn't work that much. And I tell you why I say that.
We appreciate him more?
Yes. Because he's, and I think he's keenly aware of it, he doesn't want overexposure. He is the kind of actor that is a true chameleon actor.
Mm-hmm.
When you do three movies a year like some of these actors do, you know them. I mean, there are no surprises left. It doesn't matter how good you are. When you oversaturate the market, you know.
Right.
Daniel Day-Lewis, I think he takes great pride in infusing every role with a singularity and a chameleon-like presence.
I agree. It's been like 3 years since The Ballad of Jack and Rose. That was the last movie I think he did, which is an interesting and different film for him.
And prior to that, it was
Gangs of New York.
Gangs of New York, and he had taken a 5-year hiatus.
Yes, he does. He takes long breaks.
And you know, directors like Scorsese kind of approach him with trepidation because they're like, "I know you don't want to work, but look, would you look at this?"
Yeah,
and he does want to work, you know, but he can do without work. I get that sense. He has no problem doing without work for years at a time until he finds something that he has to do. Like, don't do something unless you have to do it.
Yeah. And as John just said, his body of work definitely speaks for that. Just like the, you know, what's it, Age of Innocence, The Last of the Mohicans. And there's one that people diss a lot, which I like, and that's The Boxer.
Yeah.
I like that movie. So a friend of mine, who was back in the 90s, said, "Oh, it's just a ripoff of In the Name of the Father." I'm like, no, not really.
Not at all.
Not at all. Okay, they take place in Ireland, okay? I wanted to say, that's one of the dumbest things I've ever heard, but it always, unfortunately, that sticks with me whenever I think of The Boxer, and I just thought he was wonderful in that. I can't think of any that he hasn't been in anything bad, though.
No.
Everything I've seen him in, he stands out.
Well, absolutely, and I think that what happened to Jim Sheridan? Jim Sheridan, who was responsible for those early Daniel Day-Lewis films.
Are you talking about Get Rich or Die Trying?
Oh, was that his last film?
I think that was. I don't understand how he got attached to that. I went to go, this is the only person in the theater who went to go see that, too.
Well, talk about a chameleon. I mean, I thought Daniel Day-Lewis was a chameleon. Look at Jim Sheridan.
Yes, I know. I'm sure he doesn't want us talking about that film, but
maybe he does. I mean, it's interesting how
Terrence Howard was good in it.
You know, it's interesting how people talk about chameleon actors and that sort of thing. But the directors that really impressed me embody that same spirit.
Well, that's definitely who we were talking about earlier, Ang Lee.
Ang Lee and somebody like Curtis Hanson.
Oh, yes.
Look at those movies, like, back-to-back. The Hand That Rocks the Cradle, L.A. Confidential.
The River Wild.
The River Wild.
The Wonder Boys.
Wonder Boys and...
8 Mile.
No, give me a chance to say...
I'm sorry.
I'm just repeating what you're saying.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean that.
Just look at this quartet. I mean, L.A. Confidential, Wonder Boys, 8 Mile, In Her Shoes. Could you make more different genre films and very true to the voices of these movies, and they're all equally great.
Right.
I mean, I thought that In Her Shoes was the best film of that year.
I liked In Her Shoes. I thought Cameron Diaz was very good in it, and Toni Collette, Shirley MacLaine. I mean, I thought that was a good movie. I had no problem with that movie at all.
It's a great film.
Yeah.
And it's one of those films we were talking earlier about Kings of the Evening and how they feel like family, that cast. They feel like sisters in that movie. It's just something indefinable.
Right.
They just, you feel like that. The last time I felt like that was, and casting is everything, but I felt like that in, of all movies, EdTV, because I thought that Matthew McConaughey and Woody Harrelson, yeah, that makes sense. Those are brothers.
Yeah, that does make sense, but not, I gotta say, that movie didn't really, like, leave a big impression on me, but you did believe that, though. There's no doubt.
Well, yeah, I'm talking in terms of great familial casting.
Yeah, no, you're
and,
right.
But nothing right. tops Coburn as Nick Nolte's father in Affliction.
Oh, that's
perfect.
That's
perfect.
Wonderful.
Yeah. You couldn't cast anyone more believable as Nick Nolte's father.
That's true.
And a lot of times the movies get it wrong, you know. Chemistry is an odd thing, and just because you're two huge names doesn't mean you're going to...
Doesn't mean it's going to work.
Yeah, and you see that time and time again in certain romantic comedies.
You see that with married couples who act, too, or that are...
True. What is that about? Married couples don't have chemistry on screen.
I was thinking the remake of The Getaway and The Marrying Man with Kim Basinger and Alec Baldwin. They just really don't... There's not much... There wasn't much there.
But there's several instances of that, and I'm wondering what that is.
Hmm. I don't know if
there's a long tradition
to that.
I mean, there's a long tradition of, I would, if I recall correctly, of married couples acting across from each other on screen and romantic kind of comedy.
You know who I thought had great chemistry, and I know I'll probably be, like, thrown off the show for saying this, but Angelina Jolie and Brad Pitt, I thought, Mrs. Smith, they actually had chemistry on screen.
Steamy,
I remember talking to someone the next day, I was like, yeah, they've been seeing each other for a long time. All right, all you do is watch that movie. You're like, yeah, that's been going on for a while.
Yeah. It was apparent that they had chemistry together.
Yeah.
And there are others that just don't. But you know, I always thought that George Clooney and Michelle Pfeiffer had great chemistry in One Fine Day.
Yes, they did.
Which you know, I'm a confident man here. I'm saying that One Fine Day. Is one of my favorite romantic comedies.
It's a good movie. It's a fun movie. I remember watching that. That's a fun movie to watch.
It's another one of those feel-good kind of things, kind of movies. Puts a smile on my face, like Enchanted did.
Well, that's good. That's what it should... First and foremost, the movie should be entertaining.
Mm-hmm.
And if it does that, you know, more power to the filmmakers.
So that's your Christmas Day double feature. It's go to the theater, see Enchanted.
And then go see Alien vs. Predator.
And then come back home and watch One Fine Day. you will, hopefully you're not a diabetic. because that's a lot of sweet. You know?
That is a lot of sweet.
But both of those are great films. So how about this Will Smith? While we're waiting for, you know, we're still waiting for our next guest to call in, and then... if they're not called in by the top of the hour when Michael Mays comes on, then we're just going to go straight to Michael Mays. But how about Will Smith? He is undoubtedly king of the box office now. I mean, it's all about him.
Yes, it is.
This isn't. You could look at some previous movies. You could look at ID4. You could look at Men in Black, maybe, even, and see those opening numbers, this 4th of July, big weekends, and attribute it to the scope of the piece itself.
Right.
Or the subject matter. I think in a movie where Will Smith spends most of his time on screen by himself, or with a dog, you know.
Yeah.
And you gross the biggest opening weekend ever in the history of December.
That's power.
That's Will Smith.
Yeah, and I mean, like I said, like I said in my review for A Horror Yearbook, I said, is it possible to like the performance and not the finished product? I think the answer is yes. Well, I'm not crazy about the film. There's no denying his performance, and just he has screen presence.
Mm-hmm.
Even, I gotta tell you, I loved Ali a lot. I really thought that was great. I Robot and Hitch, you know, not great movies. He's still watchable in those films. You like watching him. He has screen presence. And
yeah, I always kind of, you know what you're getting with Hitch. But in terms of romantic comedies, I always liked Hitch. I mean,
yeah.
it's a pleasurable movie.
Yeah, but I think he brings, you know, I have to say, and even
a lot of
the Bad Boys, he brings so much to it. I mean, you'll go see it because you're like, hey, you know, it's Will Smith. I like him. And you'll definitely, you know, go see the movie, and because he has a screen presence that a lot of these guys don't have or don't have anymore. And I really respect him for that. And I respect what he did in this movie, I Am Legend. I don't know now, thinking of it, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger was attached at one time, and I guess they're trying to really go for a direct remake of the Omega Man. This was the early 90s.
It was a, wasn't it the, it was like a Ridley Scott Schwarzenegger.
Yeah, it was going to be Ridley Scott. And I do wish Ridley Scott would have directed Will Smith in this. Like another Will Smith movie I like that his brother, Tony Scott, did was Enemy of the State.
Right.
And I thought that was a great movie.
Right, right.
An enjoyable movie. So, I would have been curious to see someone else direct this one. But the performance is there. Definitely.
Yeah. And you talk about the Scott brothers. I mean, you talk about two forces in motion pictures that have made their own particular mark.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and Tony Scott, you know, no longer the younger brother struggling to keep up with Ridley. I mean, he's made blockbuster films in his own right. He has his very own. They're both incredibly stylish. I mean, first
yes.
of all, but I think Tony Scott has definitely a different kind of style going for him, and a lot of it, I think, happens in editing.
I think it happens in editing. I think you just have to go back and look at their first films. Tony Scott's The Hunger, and Ridley Scott's The Duelist. And I think if you watch those two films, and you can see, you definitely see two different styles at work being born.
Mm-hmm.
And they've both made some incredible movies. I think what Tony Scott's work he's done with Denzel Washington's incredible.
Yeah.
I really like Man on Fire a lot.
Yeah, I thought it was always interesting how you get an old pro like Robert Redford in your movie Spy Game.
That was a great, I love that movie.
Yeah, and it's definitely a movie that is, it's alive with all the style gives it like a real, like, electric feeling. And he was observing how they're shooting this, and, you know, there's a rooftop scene that he does with Brad Pitt, and Tony Scott has helicopters flying overhead with
right.
cameras mounted. He's got like 12 cameras mounted for this one scene, and Redford's just staring at it. He's just observing, and he's not judging. He just said, "I've never seen anything like this."
Right, right, yeah. I mean,
you're covering this like a live demolition, you know, for every single angle. That's how he shoots,
and I can't
imagine how daunting that is for the editor.
No, I like, and Tony seems to like to, like with a movie like Domino, he wants to recreate the end of it, another one of his movies, True Romance. Like, all of Domino seems to want to recreate the last 20 minutes of True Romance for like
right.
2 hours.
Right.
And I like Tony Scott's movies, but we've already talked about American Gangster, but I really like that film from Ridley Scott a lot.
Ridley Scott seems to be the one that's, If Tony, and maybe he's perfectly happy with this, but maybe, I hope it's not unfair. If Tony Scott's the popcorn director, Ridley Scott is the you know, more of the respectable kind of distinguished
right.
kind of.
There's an element. There's a lot of truth in that.
Yeah.
And I don't see what's wrong. I don't see what's wrong with that either.
Yeah, I think that's the consensus basically. And you look at Ridley Scott, and you know, to be his brother. To come up behind him, it must have been daunting.
I wouldn't have bothered.
Because of that stage, your brothers made Alien,
mm-hmm.
The Duelist,
Blade Runner, The Duelist, and I think Legend. No, The Hunger is before Legend, but you already have three big movies.
Yeah.
But
there was something there with The Hunger, and I really enjoyed The Hunger, and it felt very, just like Ridley Scott's movies, it felt very tactile. You could feel the atmosphere.
And then did he do Top Gun after The Hunger?
Yeah, I think so.
Wow, that's your second movie.
Yeah. Yeah, and he's talking about Jerry Bruckheimer. That's a relationship that has really favored both of them.
Yes, it has.
Iconic movies like Top Gun and help me out, what else?
Days of Thunder,
yeah.
Crimson Tide.
Right, Crimson Tide. I think Crimson Tide is probably, you know, he's done great work with Spy Game. He's done great work with some of these other films, Man on Fire. But I mean, Crimson Tide even as a Bruckheimer production, I think that stands out for me as my favorite.
Yeah, no, that's a very good one. Hackman and Washington, James Gandolfini, Viggo Mortensen. I mean, everyone's in that.
Mm-hmm. No, there are no real big action set pieces either.
Right.
But it's all about the tension of these two guys in an enclosed space in an impossible situation.
Right.
And the fact that these two are so fantastic
mm-hmm.
at what
they are.
Do.
Absolutely.
Who else would you want to see go head-to-head outside of Hackman and Washington? They're two powerhouses.
They are two powerhouses in that, and we do get to see it. You know, we get to see these performances actually the last, this year alone with 310 to Yuma, we had Christian Bale and Russell Crowe, and then we had Russell Crowe and Denzel Washington.
Yeah.
So we have been treated to this, and I guess the granddaddy of all these is Heat. De Niro and Pacino.
Yeah, which brings us to their new collaboration.
Yeah, that's going to be, yeah, I really want to see that. We all want to see that.
So we're monitoring the chat room, and a little while ago we were talking about Jim Sheridan and Get Richard Die Trying.
And John said that 50 Cent is the next Daniel Day-Lewis.
Yes. Well, hopefully so, because 50 Cent has a role in the new Pacino-De Niro movie called Righteous Kill. In this movie, unlike Heat, we were promised De Niro and Pacino have maximum screen time together. They share the movie together. They play two rival. I don't know if they're rival or not, but I think that they have some kind of twisted history together.
Right.
Cops who are investigating a murder. I don't know what it is about Pacino, as much as I love him, and having to play cops every other movie.
Right. Right.
And I guess the same could be said of De Niro, but it's...
Yeah, he plays cops a lot, too.
Yeah. But 50 Cent is in it. Brian Dennehy's in it. Carla...
Gugino's in it.
Gugino's in it. And it's directed by John Avnet. And therein raises the flags.
Okay, you're going to say that on the air? Okay. Oh, I didn't know you were going there, man.
I just... when you think De Niro and Pacino movie, you think event. And you look at a director in cop movie.
Right.
You think, all right, Michael Mann did it. Scorsese should do, you know, Scorsese's a name that comes up.
Scorsese's one who should direct Pacino, for once.
Yeah. When in that conversation, when on that list does John Avnet come up?
I don't know.
That isn't too, you know, and what, it's just, I don't mean to downplay the man.
He's probably listening right now.
I hope not, because I think he's very talented, and obviously both of these actors have a great reverence for him.
Yes.
But it doesn't really seem like his kind of movie.
No, it doesn't. We'll have to see. We'll see, like, I guess the first trailer, real trailer for it, and that will give us some idea.
Yeah, and they already came out with some behind-the-scenes footage of it. You can, if you look back through our blog.
That was a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, it's a couple of months ago now, I think.
Oh, it's months. Okay, wow. Time passes by.
Yeah, time passes by, doesn't it? But it's one of those big question marks, and that's another movie of the summer. I think it comes out in June.
Oh, they're going to put that out in June?
I think so.
Oh my! I know there's counter programming, but I would think that would be a perfect August release. But okay,
You know, that's probably a very good idea.
That's going to June. May and June are just, whoa. I mean, I wouldn't want to open my movie during that.
Open it 4th of July.
Yeah,
Sell it as the fireworks that
well,
go off.
Well, I think isn't Hellboy 2 is the first week or 2 weeks in July, so I wouldn't open, yeah, I mean, I don't know. I don't know anymore. It's going to be crowded, because I think there's a Harry Potter movie that's going to come out in that time frame, too.
Right, right. Man. Crowded summer.
It's already crowded, and it's really funny. I think 2009 is already crowded, too.
Well, he pushed back Avatar.
That's at December, so they're trying to go for the, you know, the Titanic magic again with a December release, so we'll see what happens. But I'm really, that film for 2009, I would say that's the big film.
Yeah,
that's it. They saved probably the best for last for 2009.
Mm. And the major speculation on that movie, you know, and it's to commit your life to that for so many years. I mean, he's already got years invested in this project.
He's been doing it for a long time.
Yeah, apparently with conception and finding out a way to do it, with the technology allowing him to do it.
That's right.
So just the amount of time that he spends on this, and it's very kind of secretive. I don't exactly know what is groundbreaking about it, but I just know that it will be.
Yeah, you just know that, like we were talking earlier, you know, he's a groundbreaking director. Everything he does is remembered, and I would just expect the same from this, that something, you know, he was criticized, I guess it was after Aliens or with the Abyss, he was criticized for making he was obsessed with hardware in his films, and then he made, I guess the Abyss kind of softened this, and then the Titanic really took that away. They say he could actually tell a story.
Right.
A lot of human elements, it didn't rely on special effects, and you know, he proved that he could do that. So I'm just really curious what this is going to be.
Yeah. I mean, he's got all the... I think he's almost wrapped with the actors.
Mm-hmm.
Giovanni Ribisi, Sigourney Weaver. He's got a good cast assembled there. He says they're perfect. So that segment of the shoot is wrapping, I think.
Okay.
It's curious. I don't know what it is, first of all. And then I heard someone say, maybe it was you, that... HD.
It's a 3D HD. Is I think what the technology is. I'm not positive.
Yeah.
But here's the thing. He's got Sigourney Weaver, and I always thought Sigourney Weaver. She said when she read the script for Alien, she was flabbergasted because she had no idea that someone cared so much about Ripley being Cameron to write this script. She said it was unlike anything she had seen before. She was really moved by the Alien script that he wrote, and she really wanted to do it.
Right.
Based on that, I don't think she knew that much about Cameron at the time, but she just really she was just flattered someone would write this. So I'm glad to see them working together again.
He's a remarkable writer, and like we've talked about,
yeah,
he makes great films.
Yes.
If you have any thoughts to share, you can call our number, 718-508-9477. We're waiting for our last guest to show up. Two guests tonight did not show up.
Yeah.
And that normally that is never a problem for us, but, you know, you can never kind of predict. Maybe there was some miscommunication somewhere along the way. But,
right.
We're talking hundreds of emails every week that we send out to guests, and we have... You know, this week alone, we had Jeremiah Chechik last night talking about Christmas Vacation.
Right.
Which is a holiday favorite.
It is.
Had guests on Sunday, and we bring in several guests every week, and usually it pans out fine, but some nights, you know, it doesn't quite pan out.
It happens. It happens, and hopefully we will try to reschedule them for later dates.
Yeah, I hope we can. I hope there wasn't a miscommunication in the email correspondence. But we're happy to bring the show to you tonight and to talk movies, and we hope you guys are enjoying the conversation. If there's a particular topic that you want to bring up, we have a couple of minutes before our final guest, Michael Mays, comes
on.
Yeah,
really. We have John and Dave 3 of Geeks of Doom are in the chat room. If you guys want to talk about anything, give us a call or just shoot it out in the chat room.
Absolutely. We love this chat room.
Chat room because it has like two of our best friends in it.
We have several people in there, and this chat room gets really busy. Like,
it does.
In and out throughout the life of the show, every night. So it's great to see.
It's great because this is the first time I think I've seen John. He's been a longtime friend of mine. It's the first time I've seen John in the chat room since I've been in monitoring it, and it's just great to. See John here, and it's always good to see Dave, and you know, we have very loyal and very great listeners and friends, and we appreciate that.
Yeah.
All right. Wait, now John wants us to talk about the Kevin Smith porno movie.
I don't know anything about
that. I do. John, we're not going to talk about that right now, okay, because John's just trying to bait me, I think.
I remember reading a headline. Is he serious about making that?
Yes, he is very serious. It's not a... It is, I think... John, help me out here. You've really got to help me out to explain what this movie's about. He's not. He's saying, well, no, I'm glad to be your friend, too.
No, it's. I think it's supposed to be like in the style of the, like the movies like The 40-Year-Old Virgin and Knocked Up, and it's about like it's about making an adult film.
Okay.
I'm not positive.
Well, that's not groundbreaking.
That's
I mean, there
groundbreaking.
There was a movie
Kevin
called
Smith.
The
like
Amateurs
Kevin
that
Smith.
They just
we want
did.
Kevin Smith on the show.
Well, yeah, but there's a movie called The Amateurs that was just made with Jeff Bridges that follows the same plot.
Yes, that it that is, and that I was hoping that would get a wide release. And,
me too.
And it, I think that's coming to DVD.
A wide release.
Yes,
careful.
The pun was intended there, folks. Yeah, The Amateurs was about that. There was a National Lampoon. They still make movies that are under the, and they made a movie about a high school, like a originally called After School Special, which was about the same thing. And no one saw that except for me, I think.
Right. Yeah, you're the only one.
I'm the only one who saw it, and it was groundbreakingly disappointing.
The Girl Next Door. Not the Ketchum book, but the other one.
Oh, there's that. Yeah, The Girl Next Door, which wanted to be too much like the risky business of the 21st century.
I kind of felt that way about it.
Yeah.
I kind of, you know.
I didn't mind that film as much as everyone else. I thought it was, you know, it had its moments.
Yeah, yeah.
Seth Rogen is the lead in that Kevin Smith movie.
In the porno movie we're talking
yes,
about.
Yes, in the, yes.
What a way to be referenced.
Really?
Can they find a different reference for the film? I mean, can we refer to it? Can you know? Could you call it Cloverfield, maybe, or
could
something?
It's the Kevin Smith wanted to make a horror movie, Red State, before
yeah.
this, and then the Weinsteins backed out of that, I guess, because of the.
That's right.
And because Red State was supposed to, and I would have been very curious to see a horror film from Kevin Smith.
I was excited about that.
Yes.
What's going on with that? Is it just dead in the water now?
I think the Weinsteins pulled the plug. I think after the sting of Hostel 2 and Grindhouse, they just wanted to back out.
Oh.
And I forget, did they do Awake? Was that Awake the Weinsteins?
I think maybe they did.
Okay, yeah, they definitely want to stay away from with if that's the year they're having. Oh, and Dave has given us the title of the movie.
Okay, here we go.
I'm going to read the title. Zach and is it Myri Make a Porno? Oh, that's a working title. Okay, good.
The title works for me.
All right.
Kelly LeBrock. So
Kelly LeBrock. Is she still Mrs. Steven Seagal?
It might be. No.
Okay.
No. She isn't. But, okay, Zach and Myri make a... Okay. Kelly LeBrock, so they're going for the kind of weird science vibe.
That's right. Wow.
Sounds like. Remember that movie? I mean,
yeah, that, yeah. Speaking
another
of Don
classic
Hughes,
Hughes,
yeah.
Classic Hughes.
Whoa, God, we're getting the plot details here from Dave.
Platonic friends conceive an adult film to get out of debt, but find they may have more feelings for each other.
And Elizabeth Banks, Yeah, we know, yeah, John, yeah, we know Elizabeth Banks. She was great in The 40-Year-Old Virgin. I like how your euphemism for the P-word there.
Adult, yeah.
Yeah, I liked it. That was good. That was very clever, because I would have just, never mind, we all know what I would have said.
An adult film, like, you know, Schindler's List is an adult film, and there are certain movies that are made for adults.
Like that episode of Seinfeld where they're making out in the balcony during Schindler's List.
I never remember that episode.
Oh, man.
You know what I miss is Curb Your Enthusiasm already.
Oh, I miss that already.
Yeah.
And everyone in the chat room is a big fan of that show.
Curb Your Enthusiasm, you can't get more painfully funny than that.
And that's the key word, painfully funny.
It is, and it seems to be a new form of comedy.
That's right.
And it's not quite, you know, we have the gross-out comedy. This isn't like that.
No.
This is the comedy that makes you uncomfortable.
It does, and that's a key word, uncomfortable.
What started that? I mean, obviously, Larry David, Curb Your Enthusiasm is entirely based on that. And you see it in Ricky Gervais' show Extras.
Did you watch the series finale? I haven't seen it yet.
I did. I was a little disappointed.
Oh, okay.
It still has very funny moments, but he really seems to be... It seems to be an agenda show.
Right.
Where he really wants to strike at people that just crave celebrity for the notoriety of it. You know, celebrity pores, basically, is what he
right, yeah.
He views them. And at times, I mean, their satire, that's all well and good, but at times it seems genuinely venomous.
Yes, it does. It's a good...
But I will say that second season, the first season not so much, but the second season of Extras, and I'm willing to bet it took some tips from Curb Your Enthusiasm, because the second season of Extras is classic. Every episode in that second season of Extras.
Yes. No, you're right.
And it feels like it works on that same ground that Curb Your Enthusiasm does, where you just stick him in this just incredibly awkward, demeaning, uncomfortable, painful social situations and watch him squirm.
Yeah. Oh, and that show, especially this last season of Curb Your Enthusiasm, oh my God, every episode was just...
It was great.
It was great, but you were wincing at times. You were...
What's your favorite episode of Curb?
This season? There are
any season. Any
oh, well... Well, as we all know, Larry David and my dad were separated at birth, so the show is equally painful for me to watch, because
right.
Some of the mannerisms, Jamie, I just have to walk out of the room. It's just really like, I've seen this before, like 5 minutes ago in the kitchen.
Right.
I would say one of the favorite episodes of like this past season was the one where they got the limo driver drunk.
Right.
And they're in Ted Danson's house, and... He goes, the limo driver sees Ted Danson. He goes, "Hey, what's up, Becker?" And I just love that. The show Becker. You don't use the one from Cheers or any other show. You say Becker.
Right, right.
That made me laugh so much.
It's like The Sopranos calling out to Scorsese. Hey,
it was like that. It was just, but I can't. Every show, though, was just. You know, it's something I miss it because I don't really have anything to watch right now on Sunday nights until The Wire comes on, I miss that show.
It's a very delicate thing too, because it could very easily not work, and there's some episodes that don't quite.
No, help. There's some that you're just like, eh.
It's a very delicate balance, but when it works, when it hits, it is. There's nothing more genius ever on TV, because it's about setting up these little. Tells these little morsels of stuff throughout the show, and having it all come full circle at the end, and it's always coming full circle against Larry David, you know. And a perfect example of that, and I think it's the perfect example of how good the show is.
Right.
Is The Doll.
Oh,
that
yeah.
is my favorite episode.
That's a great one.
Just how every little incident has a place. You know,
mm-hmm.
plays a definite part in that particular story, and how it all comes full circle. It's just Larry David. Plus, I appreciate Curb Your Enthusiasm so much more than Seinfeld, because Seinfeld seemed like the more colorful characters were.
Right,
side-by
characters. I agree with you. That's become very apparent. I think with each passing season for me with Curb, it's like you really do see where the genius of Seinfeld. You know, the brains behind it. Like, Larry David really was more involved in that show, and I think whatever he took from that show and he brought to Curb, Curb is the one that I'm still talking about.
And Seinfeld was the character that, when you always talked about Seinfeld, all the great moments of Seinfeld, correct me if I'm wrong, because I was never a loyal viewer, it had to do with the peripheral characters, the supporting characters.
Like the soup Nazi, or...
Right. Curb Your Enthusiasm, Larry David himself is a fascinating character. And you're constantly befuddled by him. You kind of relate to him a lot of times, and you're angered by him. And why would you do that? You know, you feel remorseful about that.
Yeah, I mean...
It's a painful show.
It's a painful show, but it is a genius show, and I am very happy that it's got two more seasons.
Yeah, me too. It's a great show. Two more seasons. That's wonderful. I mean,
two more seasons of I'm talking about a painful humor. They'll be a painful two seasons.
Okay, our last guest is on the line tonight, so let's get this started. This Friday, Walt Disney Pictures will be releasing National Treasure: Book of Secrets, the sequel to the enormously popular Nicolas Cage blockbuster. Here is the trailer for this film.
Man only has one lifetime, but history can remember you forever.
Ladies and gentlemen, I present to you one of the missing pages from the diary of John Wilkes Booth. Your great-great-granddaddy planned the assassination of President Lincoln.
It can't be.
We cannot have him remembered as a conspirator in the assassination of the man who brought this nation together.
I need to see the page.
Look at this.
There's a symbol stamped into the page.
The eagle clutching the scroll.
Do you know what it means?
The president's secret book.
Come on, it's a myth.
It contains all of our nation's secrets. The JFK conspiracy and Area 51.
This book could prove my grandfather's innocence. All I need is a few minutes with the president.
The Secret Service is never going to leave you alone, Mr. President.
Well, you never know. I'm sorry, Mr. President. I need to ask you a question.
Code one! Code one!
The book exists.
But you are now number one on the NSA, the CIA, and the FBI's most wanted list.
Is that for us? Oh, hello.
This symbol designates the secret tunnel that will lead us to the greatest treasure of all time.
How fast can we get to Buckingham Palace?
Someone else knows about the book.
You've got to find where that leads before they do.
What's the final clue?
Another Gates family quest.
Wait, that could be a horrible trap.
Sorry, I couldn't resist.
National Treasure, Book of Secrets.
Riley, what do you see?
Death and despair. Mostly death, though. I mean, a little despair the last few seconds, but then a hard, sudden death.
Wow, that trailer plays exciting just on the radio.
Yes, it does.
National Treasure, Book of Secrets features a stellar cast, including Nicolas Cage, Helen Mirren, Ed Harris, John Voight, and our guest tonight, Michael Mays. Michael has appeared in some of our best television series, like Reigns, ER, CSI New York, NCIS, and Numbers. And he can also be seen in the recent Hallmark film Final Approach, co-starring Leah Thompson and Anthony Michael Hall. It is a great pleasure to welcome to the show actor Michael Mays. Michael, are you with us?
I am. How's it going?
Thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me.
This has got to be an exciting time for you. This is it's a big movie. You're 2 days out from having your face plastered on thousands of screens worldwide. How are you feeling inside?
I am. I'm very, very excited. I saw it for the second time last night. We had like a cast and crew screening out here, and I saw the premiere in New York last week, and I'm totally stoked. It's really a great, fun movie. I think it's going to do really well.
So what? We're all crazy about the first one, but what can we expect with the second film?
Well, having Helen Mirren and Ed Harris in it, I think, adds a nice little flavor to it. You know, Helen Mirren has a lot of great, funny comic stuff with John Voight, and they have a great little chemistry and combination going on. And Ed Harris, you know, is a pretty amazing actor, and I think he adds a really good feel to the bad guys. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And you know, it's definitely along the same range. There's a lot of action stuff in this one still, and if not even more. And it also goes internationally, which is different than the first, which is pretty fun. It goes to Paris and to London, and the rest of it is in America, I think. But yeah, it's very exciting and pretty action packed, and it's pretty cool.
So tell me about the character that you play in the film.
Well, Ed Harris is a new bad guy, and his name is Mitch Wilkinson, and then he basically just has two kind of family members, cousins that are they're henchmen kind of stuff, and so I'm one of those henchmen. So I'm basically in all the scenes with Ed and do a lot of like shooting, have a couple lines here and there in the car chases, and do a little headlock to John Voight, and just, you know, some nice heavy henchman stuff.
So tell me about that's the thing about Jerry Bruckheimer Productions. The casting is amazing. And so exceptional. You're not used to the action genre and enjoying such great kind of serious character actors. But
right.
Talking about Ed Harris and John Voight, tell me about watching them and working with them and observing them. What are your impressions of that experience?
Well, you know, I worked on and off for 5 months, and it really, and most of that time was spent with Ed, you know, and it was just, he's been such an inspiration already before I even met him in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
But I think he's done such great character work, and I do a lot of character acting, and so just being there and observing him and observing how he, like, acts on the set, how he acts with the director, how he just acts with the actors and just all the crew and everything. And it was just pretty amazing to see, like, his professionalism, how he prepares for the role, how he gets into it right before, you know, the camera starts rolling. And I was also able to hang out with him a lot. You know, there was a lot of downtime, and we were in South Dakota for 2 weeks and in London for 3 weeks. And there was a lot of time to just chill and, you know, go see a play or go have a beer at the pub and just hang out. So it was pretty, like, astounding, you know, and amazing. John Voight I met on the first day, so it was definitely a little nerve-wracking, and it started right with our stunt of, like, me, there's this little scene where I kind of capture him, and we get stuff from him, but it was like, okay, enter into this crazy, huge movie world, and you're first going to be with John Voight, and you have this stunt, you know, where you could possibly hurt him, and, you know, all this stuff. He was super, super kind, and very, very cool, and even last week, you know, I went to the my parents came in and stopped, and, like, you know, Ed and him were talking to us, and there was a really cool, kind, professional cast, you know?
Yeah.
Pretty amazing for, like, for my first feature for that to be the case, you know?
It's great to be, and I find this similarity a lot, that the greatest actors tend to be the greatest people, I mean, too. Just the nicest, most giving, kind of sympathetic kind of people that there are.
Yeah.
And that's great. That's great to hear about the two of them. So how did this part come about for you? Was it a typical kind of audition process?
It actually was. It was extremely typical. I had actually, the casting director, her name is Ronna Kress. She's done a lot of big stuff, and I had been into her for one other feature, and then I was into her for this movie for another role, and then a month later I got called in for this role, and it was very simple. It was put on tape for the director. It was just her, and I think I did it twice, and I got a call, like, probably a month and a half later. Like, it was completely just off my mind. I just did it, and it was out of sight, out of mind kind of thing. And they basically called and were like, they want you. They just have to finalize, you know, everyone at Jerry Bruckheimer's office now has to okay you. So we're going to call you back within 24 hours to give you the final word. And if we do, you're going to be flying to Washington, D.C. in, like, 2 days, so be prepared for that. And you need to make sure you have a passport because you're going to London after that.
Was that the longest 24 hours you had to wait for that phone call?
Yeah. Luckily, I only ended up waiting, like, 8 hours. They ended up calling at the end of the day. But,
oh, great.
And my agent played a joke where she called and she was all, like, you know, sounded all down and that they had called. And it was pretty funny. Needless to say, I was very stoked at that moment.
So when did you first catch the acting bug, and who were some of the initial actors that inspired you?
Way back when, you know, I have two older brothers, and they were doing shows when I was, you know, like, in grade school. They were doing them when they started to go into junior high and high school, and I always, like, for some reason, I really liked it, and I really wanted to do the same thing, and so that was probably an initial inspiration. And then I got into it more in high school and then into college, but I was always more, like, stage up until after college when I came out here, which was more of a fluke and stuff. Mm-hmm. But after being out here, like, I really do a lot of character work, and I love people that can really just jump into a role and completely, like, transform into another person just on a very low-key basis, you know, like a Philip Seymour Hoffman or an Ed Norton or Anthony Hopkins or, you know, like, on a female side, like a Glenn Close and Meryl Streep kind of stuff, you know?
Sure.
That type of stuff. So, which is another reason why, you know, I think Ed Harris falls in that category. So it was just kind of, it was great to be there, you know?
Is there a difference for you? Because I know that you know, you've done theater, TV, film work. Is there a difference in the kind of disciplines in acting and those different mediums for you?
Discipline and technique, or discipline like while you're working on set and stuff like that?
Well, in terms of technique, I would think obviously
right.
Obviously, it's a different, maybe a different pace in certain of these mediums and a different kind of
I definitely think it's almost like on a whole other like plane of reality, but the discipline is same within that plane. Like I think with theater, there's a discipline in like, you know, that you're warming up and you're doing vocal exercises and you're needing to project and you're needing to like act and communicate on this certain level. And it took like a good 2 or 3 years after being out here to kind of like work myself into the whole other genre of like film and TV, which is pretty different, especially doing a lot of character work. You know, it was a lot of stuff on the outside that I had to learn how to internalize and kind of just draw with from within and stuff. But I think there's definitely the same discipline in breaking apart the scene and breaking apart the character and kind of getting into the history of the character and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
But then I found that there's a big just kind of like almost once all that work is done, I'm just really just letting it go and just kind of being there in the moment, you know, almost like it's just kind of yourself, but a different extension of yourself as opposed to theater, which I think tends to be more projected outward, you know?
Yeah, sure. And with a film like this, I've always wondered this. A big movie like National Treasure 2, obviously there, it's such a massive production, and to be at the helm of a movie like that, and I know that John Turteltaub did an exceptional job with the last one. What kind of set does he maintain? What's the feeling on that set?
It's extremely professional, and you know that you can't get away with stuff. You can sense that about the set, you know? It's not like it's so casual that, like, there's mistakes being made and, you know, like, you can kind of slough off. So there's definitely, like, a high professionalism air going on.
Yeah.
But at the same time, he's, like, super laid back and, like, always cracking jokes and, like, and never really very serious. You know what I mean? If he is, it's in a good way, but just, you know, if, like, if it needs to... It was extremely casual and fun and just, like, and just very, very cool. You know what I mean? And you can kind of tell that about the sets and stuff like that, but...
Yeah, I would think that that would be crucial to kind of maintain a relaxed feeling, especially in a big, multi-layer project like that. And it's so daunting, that kind of scope of movie. Tell me about Eagle Eye. Tell me, that's your next film?
I just actually filmed it. It has Rosario Dawson and Billy Bob. My scene is with Rosario Dawson, and I filmed that a couple weeks ago. I kind of have this confrontational scene with Rosario Dawson and have some fun with her, and she's trying to, like, it's kind of like a 24 kind of a movie.
Yeah.
The whole FBI thing going on, and she's basically trying to get into these quarters, and I play this military guy, and we have a confrontation and stuff. It's very cool, though.
That's exciting. Are you going to watch National Treasure this weekend in the theater with an audience?
Yes. Funnily enough, I'm actually going home on Friday and to Milwaukee, and my parents have rented out a theater and invited about 200 family and friends of my past, from my great aunt to my family dentist growing up.
Everyone you've ever met. That's great.
Yeah, exactly.
That's great. Well, we wish you a great time and great success, and I'm sure the best is yet to come for you. And thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Totally. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, sir.
All right, cool.
Bye-bye now.
Bye.
Michael Mays, co-star of National Treasure 2. That's going to be a huge movie. And we definitely wanted to hear his perspective of his experience working on that film. And
definitely.
What a place to be found opposite Ed Harris and John Voight in a big film like, you know, a Bruckheimer production. Like
it doesn't get much bigger than that. And like you said, this one, it just has a great cast.
All of the Bruckheimer films do. I mean, an unusually high-caliber cast for the types of... I mean, obviously, they're all crowd-pleasers, but for a crowd-pleasing movie.
Right.
Seriously good actors.
Yes,
Absolutely.
Yeah. Who you don't normally... I think he goes after those actors that you don't normally equate with an action piece of escapism.
Well, if you're an actor, would you turn him down? I wouldn't.
No, because he knows how to make these movies.
Yeah, I wouldn't turn him down.
He's absolutely tried and true proven. But you can look no further than Johnny Depp. Johnny Depp, who anti-kind of establishment, kind of does his own thing. He's delighted by the opportunity to do Pirates of the Caribbean.
Wanted to make a movie that his daughter could see.
Yeah, and plus it is like all the other roles that he strives to find. It gives him an opportunity to create a character from the bottom up, use like all these wacky inspirations and combine them. And they gave him free rein. I mean, they're smart enough to do that, to offer it to an actor that's not necessarily usually associated with that kind of film,
right?
And to give them free rein to do what they do, you know, which I think elevates the film.
Right. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, from your typical action kind of spectacle.
No, he's definitely, I mean, he's an institution. Bruckheimer is an institution. He knows what he's doing. And these films, like you made, and the Pirates are a good example, too. Just incredible. Incredible stuff.
Yeah, well, we apologize for the two guests that did not show up tonight. I will get to the bottom of it.
But we do have, on Sunday, we have the legendary director John Sayles, Lone Star, Brother from Another Planet, and the upcoming Honey Dripper.
Yes. And in January, our Sundance series, our One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest cast reunion, our Golden Globe pre-show coverage, our interview with action icon Dolph Lundgren. I tell you what, January, I mean, the new year, we're ringing in the new year big.
With Dolph.
Big with Dolph.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be, look, 2008 is going to be a big year. We got a lot of great films coming out, and we're going to cover all of them.
Yeah, it's going to be a great year for Movie Geeks United, thanks in no small part to everyone out there that's supported us.
Yeah, I mean, everyone in the chat room has supported us from the very beginning tonight, and we love you guys.
Yeah, absolutely. This show's yours as much as it is ours. Any suggestions, anything you want to heard talked about on the show or topics you want covered, please drop us an email at our MySpace account, and we'll be happy to respond. That's it, Guy.
Okay.
So it's been a fun show.
It has been. It was great.
Thanks, everyone, for listening in, and we'll see you Sunday night.
All right. Good night, everyone.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.